mission to transform the lives of others.
I think I always wanted to live my life with a purpose.
Hearing about their experiences.
I've been hugged countless times out there.
The new series of Cafe Hope on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting next Monday morning at 9:45.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 13th of September. Good morning. This is Today with Justin Webb and Michelle Hussein.
The headlines this morning, Keir Starmer will discuss the war in Ukraine with President Biden after Russia warned of a direct conflict with Europe and the US if it's attacked with long-range Western missiles. Donald Trump has told supporters he's ruling out another televised presidential debate.
Because we've done two debates and because they were successful, there will be no third debate.
Also on the programme, the BMA union will join us live after the health secretary said this to us yesterday.
We still see sabre-rattling, the unnecessary threat of collective action, which, let's be clear, would harm patients and put more burden on their colleagues in other parts of the NHS.
One of the biggest investors in space technology tells us why the projects he's backing will solve urgent problems here on Earth. And as Amazon's grand tour comes to an end, James May will be with us to look back on the partnership of three that began with Top Gear. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has arrived in Washington for talks with President Biden after Vladimir Putin issued his starkest warning yet about the dangers of loosening restrictions on the use of weapons supplied by the West. The Russian leader said that Europe and the United States would be in direct conflict with Moscow if they allowed Kiev to attack Russian territory with long-range Western missiles. In response, Sir Keir stressed Ukraine's right to self-defence. Our political editor Chris Mason sent this report from Washington.
This is Sir Keir Starmer's second visit to the White House in 2 months. Ukraine's allies still remain rather guarded in their public remarks about a change in policy on the use of Western missiles inside Russia, but the diplomatic dashing to arrive at a decision is in plain sight. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Foreign Secretary David Lammy in Kyiv this week, the Prime Minister's in Washington today. There are really important developments likely in the next few weeks and months, and therefore a number of tactical decisions ought to be taken, the Prime Minister told us. He was more direct in his response to Vladimir Putin's threats. Russia started this, he said. Moscow caused the conflict, and it could stop it.
In the past few minutes, it's been reported that Russia has revoked the accreditation of 6 British diplomats, accusing them of espionage. Russia's Interfax news agency said the State Security Service didn't name the 6, but claimed their activities threatened the country's security. A specially convened panel, which was selected to mirror the population, has said the law should be changed in England to allow terminally ill adults to end their life if they wish. The research group, known as a citizens' jury, was commissioned by the Nuffield Council on Bioethics to explore public views. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
The 30-member jury spent 8 weeks hearing evidence from experts and campaigners. Jurors voted by 3-1 in favour of assisted dying being available to those with a terminal condition who have the capacity to make their own decisions. Key motivations for supporting a change in the law were to stop pain and knowing that you could die with dignity. Those against were worried it could be misused without adequate safeguards.
Donald Trump has said he will not take part in another televised US presidential debate against his Democratic opponent, Kamala Harris. He made the announcement on social media, insisting he was the victor in Tuesday's debate. But some polls suggest Ms. Harris won, with Mr. Trump's claim that immigrants had eaten pets facing particular criticism. Mr. Trump told supporters at a rally in Arizona the moderators were biased, and he rejected claims that he'd performed poorly.
As everyone saw 2 nights ago, we had a monumental victory over comrade Kamala Harris in the presidential debate. Kamala Harris showed up spewing empty rhetoric, the same old lies, meaningless platitudes, offering no plans, no policies, and no details whatsoever, nothing.
The government has confirmed that a ban on junk food adverts being shown on television before 9 in the evening will come into force from October next year. Our correspondent Vincent McAvinney has more.
The Royal Society for Public Health has welcomed Labour's confirmation of a junk food advertising ban, describing it as key to building a healthier future for the next generation. The policy, which was in Labour's manifesto, will not only see junk food advertising stopped on TV before the watershed, but also a total ban on paid-for online adverts to tackle childhood obesity. The Health Minister, Andrew Gwynn, says that more than one in five children in England are overweight or obese by the time they start primary school, rising to more than a third by the time they leave.
Thousands of workers for the aircraft manufacturer Boeing have voted overwhelmingly to strike in a dispute about pay at its plant in Seattle. The industrial action represents another setback for the company, which has been trying to restore its reputation after a number of incidents, including in January this year when a panel blew off a 737 MAX aircraft. Researchers have solved the mystery of what caused a seismic signal which was detected around the world for 9 days in September last year. The international team say the event was triggered by a landslide in Greenland that led to a tsunami in a fjord. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has been finding out more.
When seismic sensors around the planet picked up the unusual signal emanating from Greenland, a group of geologists set out to solve the mystery of what was causing it. They eventually worked out that this vibration that lasted an unprecedented 9 days came from a massive landslide that triggered a tsunami in a remote fjord in the east of the country. Before and after images revealed that a whole mountaintop had collapsed there, sending a volume of rock equivalent to 25 Empire State Buildings slamming into the water.
Victoria Gill reporting.
Thank you. 6 minutes past six is the time. Let us have our first go at the weather. It comes from Stav Danaos at the BBC Weather Centre this morning. Hello, Stav.
Hi there, Justin and Michelle. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. Well, high pressure has now moved in from the west. It's cut off the Arctic northerly airflow and it'll replace it with a milder southwesterly breeze. So by the weekend, temperatures will recover back to the seasonal norm with stronger southwesterly winds for northwestern parts of the UK with rain at times here, but also plenty of sunshine, especially for England and Wales. And then into next week, we should continue to see high pressure dominating, I think, for much of the first half of the week. That'll bring more settled and dry weather with temperatures around, or in fact, just a little above average. So it will be warming up for all of us. Today, though, for England, Scotland and Wales, it is a cold start out there for the time of year. Touch of frost in places first thing. Also some mist and fog patches to watch out for. It is a mostly dry start, but a few coastal showers affecting eastern England, some around Irish Sea coast, but most of them will be across the northwest of Scotland. However, most places will see sunshine through this morning and into the afternoon. A bit of fair weather cloud bubbles up at times, and that could set off the odd light shower, but nothing as heavy as we've seen over the last few days. Winds will remain very light as well from the north or the west. Northern Ireland, a cold start for you too. The odd shower peppering northern and western coast. Otherwise, it's a day, a bright morning with some sunshine, but through the afternoon, cloud will tend to build along with a freshening southwesterly breeze. So temperatures today still below par for the time of year for now. 11 to 14 degrees for Scotland, Northern Ireland, 13 to 17 degrees for England and Wales, and perhaps a degree or so warmer than it's been the last couple of days. I'll have more for you later.
Stav, thank you very much. 8 minutes past six. Let's have a look at the papers and news website. Keir Starmer's comments that President Putin could end the conflict in Ukraine straight away are the lead for The Guardian and The Times. The Times says it expects discussions between the Prime Minister and President Biden at the White House to represent a shift from the present policy of staying the course to one where there is some form of end to the conflict. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has spoken to the Daily Telegraph, saying the coming months will be crucial in helping Kyiv get into a position to win.
The Daily Mail focuses on the government's plans for a pre-watershed ban on junk food advertising and a total ban on paid advertising online. It says Sir Keir Starmer has indicated the measures are part of a bid to crack down on child obesity, but the paper describes it as a new era of the nanny state and quotes critics as saying it'll do little to tackle Britain's bulging waistlines. The Times says the ban will be the first of several tough public health measures that ministers believe are essential to save the NHS.
A warning from the government's fiscal watchdog that the UK's public debt is on an unsustainable upward upward path because of trends like population ageing and the costs of climate change, is the lead in the Financial Times. The Office for Budget Responsibility says surging public spending is projected to raise the ratio of public debt to 274% of GDP over the coming 50 years, compared with less than 100% now. The FT says the watchdog found a sustained period of tight budgetary policy would be needed to bring the public finances into a more healthy state, with an average budget clampdown of 1.5% a decade to bring debt back towards pre-pandemic levels.
Dame Esther Ranson's bid to change the law on assisted dying is the lead in the Express, as the paper reports that the first citizen's jury has backed a change in the law to allow people who are terminally ill to have help to end their lives. Dame Esther has terminal lung cancer herself. The paper says a clear 71% of those in the jury, which was 30 people, supported the change. We'll be hearing, by the way, from that jury in an hour or so's time. And it quotes Dame Esther as saying that the verdict confirms that the vast majority of the public believe the law on assisted dying urgently needs reform.
The Sun is among papers to report that touching wood is not just for bringing good luck, but that it can have the same calming effect on our nerves as stroking a pet. It quotes Professor Baroness Cathy Willis from the University of Oxford, who told the Instant Genius podcast that the smell of wood also plays a part, and that the scent is still beneficial decades after a tree has been cut down.
And a number of the front pages carry extraordinary photos of the US billionaire Jared Isaacman silhouetted against the glowing globe of the Earth after he completed the world's first commercial spacewalk yesterday as part of a SpaceX mission. His words, "The world looks perfect from here," top the photo in the Telegraph.
11 minutes past six is the time.
Donald Trump is not going back for another round in the ring with Kamala Harris. I asked Jenny Kumar, our correspondent in Washington, does that make it likely that Donald Trump takes a further loss by not debating again?
Trump has said that he won the debate against Biden in June, and he won the debate against Harris earlier this week, and that the vice president should focus on her job as vice president, and that she only wanted another debate because she lost the one on Tuesday. Now, both are claiming victory, but some snap polls suggest that Kamala Harris did perform better. And we did have some political commentators suggesting that Donald Trump taking that highly unusual step of appearing straight after the debate in the spin room to talk to hundreds of journalists was because he didn't actually feel it had gone that well.
No, well, obviously he doesn't. I mean, he lost, didn't he? The question, I suppose, now is whether he takes a further loss by not debating again or not.
Yeah. So we've heard from someone called Adam Green, who's from an organisation that's advised the Harris campaign on economic messaging. And he suggested that actually Trump has done Ms Harris a double favour, because viewers are left with a lasting impression of the vice president looking presidential, he says. A second debate would probably have helped her, but she also ran the risk of it not going her way. But now, with Trump saying there won't be a third one, he's actually removed that jeopardy. And some other reaction we've had from an independent voter, he said that he felt that basically there was nothing in it for Donald Trump to do it again. That, you know, he'd kind of lost the momentum, that he probably feels he can't get those social media sound bites, so there's no benefit for him doing another one.
Jenny Kumar in Washington, thank you.
30 minutes past six, and meanwhile, the Prime Minister has arrived in the US ahead of a White House meeting with President Biden. Later, Leila Nathu, our political correspondent, joins us from Westminster. And it does seem that Ukraine is going to be the dominant theme for these talks, Leila.
Yeah, certainly. And although no one is saying it explicitly, it does seem like all the signs are that Ukraine, or certainly decisions are going to be made relating to whether Ukraine can get the Storm Shadow missiles that it's after. I mean, Keir Starmer's been quite explicit that, you know, in his words on the way to Washington, saying that there are going to be some important developments likely in the next few weeks and months. That is why he wants this private forum with President Biden again. There is the context of David Lammy, the foreign secretary, having met his counterpart Antony Blinken in Kyiv, talking about a significant escalation this week in that Iran has transferred missiles to Russia. That is another thing being echoed by Number 10. So you can see the direction of travel. Clearly, this is an important staging post along the way, Keir Starmer is going to be travelling to Italy at the end of the week after he gets back from Washington. Then there is a meeting at the UN the following in next week as well. So you can see that these conversations are happening. Keir Starmer is being very defiant. He's talking about Russia starting this conflict, emphasising again that Ukraine has this right to self-defence. You can see this is top of the agenda and where it's going.
We'll be talking about this later in the programme, including with the Polish foreign minister. At home, we now know that there will be a junk food advertising ban coming in next year. What do we know about how it will work and how they will define junk food?
Well, this is a very interesting development. It's something that was long promised by Boris Johnson, in fact, a few years ago, long delayed, never actually implemented, but was confirmed. You know, it was in Labour's manifesto. It was confirmed yesterday on the day that Keir Starmer talked about wanting to refocus the NHS on prevention. And this is something he promised. It's one of the examples of it. So this is a ban on junk food on television pre 9 o'clock and online completely coming in from October next year. There's going to be a consultation on various aspects of it. But it clearly shows that this Labour government is prepared to take on accusations. They are being interventionist, too interventionist in some people's eyes, in order to take on the state of the nation and this nation's public health.
Leila Nathu, thank you.
It is 6:15. We've talked a lot about the cancellation of the northern leg of HS2, but there is a new report. It's a report commissioned by the mayors of Greater Manchester and the West Midlands. It's come up with a new possible rail link and indeed a new way to fund it. More on that now and the rest of the business news. Felicity Hannah, morning, Felicity.
Morning. Yes, so this new report says the private sector should help fund a new 80-kilometre rail link between the two city regions of Birmingham and Manchester. The engineering consultancy firm are a part of the consortium behind the link. They're responsible for today's analysis. And Richard Decaney is global director at the firm, joins me now here in Salford studio. Richard, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So what is the proposal? Why is it needed?
Thank you. So we've been working with the mayors of Greater Manchester and the West Midlands Combined Authorities to explore this question of the importance of connectivity between the West Midlands and Greater Manchester, recognising that the existing infrastructure, the West Coast Main Line, is under enormous stress, ageing infrastructure at capacity with reliability challenges. The M6 is amongst the most congested roads in the UK. And whilst High Speed 2 will add capacity between London and Birmingham, there will be no additional capacity north of Birmingham to Manchester, and also no additional freight paths. Mm. And that means we'll be reliant on the existing network going forward for connectivity. And our analysis shows within the next decade, the line will be full. And we believe that will have a significant impact on economic growth, productivity, and the ability to meet the UK's ambitions for economic transformation.
So that you're making a case for it, but we know that money is tight. We know the public purse is under pressure. How do you propose funding this?
Yeah, so we've been looking, as a group of seven organisations led by ARUP, we've got experience of working around the world on infrastructure projects of different types. And there is a global market for looking at infrastructure projects differently in terms of finance and delivery. And we have a history of doing that in the UK. We have projects like the high-speed line from St Pancras to the Channel Tunnel. We have projects in London such as the Docklands Light Railway and extensions of the Tube, like the Northern Line extension, that have been delivered in different ways using a combination of private finance, new delivery structures and alternative funding models. And we believe on this corridor between Birmingham and Manchester, because the land has already been secured in the main and because the powers and the planning consents exist from High Speed 2, we're in a unique opportunity to look at this differently and to look at how we can use and harness private sector support and involvement in making this project a reality.
But you'd still want government funding as well?
Yeah, I think if you look what happens elsewhere in Europe, and there are well-established models in France and Italy for delivering new rail projects differently. And there is always a blend of the public sector working with the private sector. So we recognise this isn't something we don't believe that can be delivered entirely by the private sector. This is complex, but it's about a different way of thinking. And this is about working in partnership and using the private sector innovation, ideas around reducing cost, finance, to work with the public sector to make this happen.
It's interesting you mentioned reducing costs. So this report suggests this line could be built quite a bit more cheaply than the original HS2 plan, perhaps for as little as 60 to 75% of the original costs. The last government, though, said that scrapping the northern leg of HS2 saved £36 billion. So 75% of that is still a whopping figure. Do you really think that the government and private investment can cough up that much?
Yeah, so we've looked at this afresh based on our experience as a group working overseas. And we think when you start to think about the cost of infrastructure and how you can bring that cost down, you have to look at how you can deliver it differently to incentivize the organizations responsible for delivery to be efficient in how they design it, but also in how they deliver it. So we think, yes, there are some opportunities to rethink some of the design assumptions that would bring the cost down, but actually putting the responsibility and the risk in the right place can have a significant benefit in terms of more efficient delivery.
Now, you've carried out this report with the mayors. Have you had any discussion with government yet?
So we, as organisations, we talk to government all the time about infrastructure in the UK, and I think we all know that we have an infrastructure deficit in the UK. We need to invest in our national infrastructure, particularly rail. We are fully aware of the financial constraints that we find ourselves in, and that public funding is tight, and we need to prioritise it on those things that rely solely on public funding. What we think this project presents is the opportunity to reduce the reliance on solely the public sector to deliver, but to create a new model of delivery. And if we get that right here, because of the unique circumstances, because we have most of the land, we have the powers, this might be a model that we could extend to other projects in the UK.
Richard DeCainay from the engineering consultancy firm Arup, thank you very much indeed. And a Department for Transport spokesperson said, "Transport is an essential part of our mission to rebuild Britain. We are absolutely committed to improving rail connectivity across the north and working with devolved leaders as set out in the government's manifesto," and added that they're currently reviewing the position they've inherited on HS2, and we can expect some next steps in due course. Right, some breaking news in the last half hour or so. In a big blow to the firm's new chief executive, Boeing workers have voted overwhelmingly, 96% of them, to go on strike. That strike will begin at midnight Pacific time in the US. It'll be 8 a.m. here in the UK. Let's talk to Jane Foley, senior FX strategist at Rabobank. Jane, good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, this is just the latest for a company that saw already had some pretty tough headlines recently.
That's exactly right. And, you know, and it had been thought that maybe this deal would be accepted. I mean, it was for a 25% pay rise. There was also a commitment to build the next domestic plane in Seattle. But the original deal was for a 40%, or the original demands, I should say, was for a 40% pay rise. And it seems that workers are holding on to this. Now, of course, we have had a new chief executive in the last month or so for Boeing. And his job was really to turn around the reputation of Boeing. But again, this is just another bad sign in what has been a stream of technical issues, really, for the manufacturer.
Let's talk about a different company also having a struggle. Shares of Adobe, the Photoshop maker, fell 9.2% after the bell yesterday. I mean, this is high interest rates and a tough economy leading to cost cutting, which has stunted the company's growth. Can it come back from that?
I think it can. I mean, if we actually look at the earnings for the third quarter, the earnings and revenues actually topped expectations. It was really the outlook for the fourth quarter that missed the analysts' expectations. But, you know, if we look through in the last few months, technology, and of course Adobe is a bellwether for that sector, has had a difficult time, the market trying to grapple with whether or not there's been too much optimism into the price of tech shares about the ability of tech or its capabilities in the future. So again, I think it's confronting these sort of broader issues in the market.
And briefly, Jane, OpenAI is in talks to raise $6.5 billion from investors after a new valuation set the company's value at $150 billion. That is significantly higher than the $86 billion it was valued at earlier this year. How is it possible to increase that much in that time?
It's fairly mind-blowing, really. But this, of course, its best product is, of course, ChatGPT. And I think most people in the planet will now have come across ChatGPT LGBT, maybe not used it, but certainly heard of its capabilities. And of course, we've got to think about who are OpenAI's big investors, and they are Microsoft, Apple, and NVIDIA themselves, huge names in this arena. So there, again, this is all related to the expectation of what AI could potentially do for us in the future.
Jane Foley, thank you very much indeed. Now, the Office for Budget Responsibility says the UK's national debt is on course to treble over the next 50 years. But it's not all doom and gloom. The forecaster also says increasing productivity could solve it. The trouble is, of course, we've been trying to improve productivity for years. Let's talk to Diane Coyle, who's researcher at the Productivity Institute and professor of public policy at the University of Cambridge. Professor Coyle, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
You are clearly the person with all the productivity answers. First of all, though, just bring us up to speed on that forecast for a tripling national debt. What's feeding into that?
There are pressures such as the increasing age of the population on health spending. And more fundamentally, in the UK, we've been trying to have public services at European levels and taxes at American levels, and that's not sustainable. So if the forecasts for how we're going to spend continue as they are and the tax assumptions stay as they are, then that gap becomes unsustainable. And that's the dilemma that the Chancellor is facing at the budget, obviously.
That's interesting when you compare us to the US in some terms and Europe in others, because UK productivity isn't that terrible overall. So in 2023, we came fourth out of the G7 countries, very middle of the pack. In terms of productivity, though, we are about 18% lower than the US, which came first. Why?
Productivity growth in the United States has returned to the kind of path it was on before the financial crisis. And in the UK and some other European countries, that's not the case. So our level of productivity is not that much higher than it was in 2005, so almost 20 years ago, and whereas it's increased substantially in the United States. And so the question then becomes, why is that? And why do we, in terms of growth, seem to be doing a little bit worse than many of our European comparators? Because as the OBR said yesterday, if you can increase productivity growth to what it was before the financial crisis, then you solve a lot of that fiscal dilemma, because the increasing growth in the economy increases the tax take.
If you can't improve productivity, then does that mean that as a country, higher taxes are a more likely option?
Well, that's what makes the dilemma such a sharp one. What matters isn't the level of debt in pounds terms. It's how big is it relative to the size of the economy, and therefore how much do taxpayers have to stump up to pay the interest on that debt. So debt sustainability depends on growth, at least as much as it depends on the tax and spending decisions. And obviously, if we can get growth going, that's a much, much less painful way to think about making the debt sustainable.
Diane Coyle, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that. Let us turn to the sport now, which is with Cathy. Morning, Cathy.
Morning, Michelle. Thank you very much. A hearing to examine 115 Premier League charges against Manchester City will begin on Monday. City were referred to an independent commission by the Premier League in February of 2023 over allegedly breaking the financial rules of the competition. They have won the Premier League for a record-breaking four seasons in a row. The BBC sports editor Dan Rowan outlines the charges.
These charges are spread over 14 seasons. They stand accused of subverting profit and sustainability rules, which limit losses by failing to provide, in effect, accurate financial information. Now, City, it's important to stress, have always strongly denied the charges. And while the speculation is intensifying, of course, no one truly knows what the outcome will be.
Golf and Charlie Hull and Nelly Korda will face each other in today's opening match of the Solheim Cup in Virginia. Hull is partnered with German rookie Esther Henslight for Team Europe, while world number one Korda is paired with Alison Corpus. The American pair were successful in the last Solheim Cup, winning both of their foursomes matches. But the American captain, Stacey Lewis, said her pairings were about more than just golf.
In picking the players, it was important to have, you know, the 12 that got along really well, 12 that really meshed, 12 that offered me a ton of pairing options, just to be able to find who's playing the best and mix them up.
There's commentary of day one of the Solheim Cup from 5 o'clock on the BBC Sport website and app and on 5 Live from 8.30. Rory McIlroy is just two shots off the lead of England's Tom Clements after day one of the Irish Open at Royal County Down. The world number three finished his first round with a hat-trick of birdies to card a 3-under-68. Rugby union and centre Emily Scarrett will become the third England women's player to start 100 games for England on Saturday when they face world champions New Zealand in the first fixture at the newly named Allianz Stadium. Great Britain's Davis Cup tennis team face Argentina today in Manchester, but after a tight 2-1 win in their opening tie against Finland, captain Leon Smith has asked that the crowd make more noise to help the team make the most of their home advantage. And the 22-time Grand Slam champion Rafael Nadal has pulled out of this month's Laver Cup. The 38-year-old has not played since his defeat alongside Carlos Alcaraz in the men's doubles at the Paris Olympics last month. Racing tips return, as they do for big meetings, on the calendar. It is the St. Ledger Festival at Doncaster, so give these a go. 2:25, number 3, John Quill, and also Doncaster, 3 o'clock, number 1, Asterios.
Carthy, thank you. Tomorrow Radio 4 explores how a musical icon was reborn.
David Bowie in Berlin.
Nobody actually wanted to live in Berlin. Everybody was trying to get out.
How a move to the city in the 1970s saved his life and career.
He had a great weight on his shoulders. He was very depressed.
He wanted fresh air.
A revealing insight into the artist's life in the epicenter of the Cold War, with unheard archive and new interviews with those who were there.
Yes, we're lovers, and that is that. That's true.
Bowie in Berlin, with me, Francis Whateley, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tomorrow night at 8.
And the time is now 6:30. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer has backed Ukraine's right to defend itself after President Putin warned the West it was at risk of entering into a war with Russia. Mr. Putin said Moscow would take appropriate decisions if Ukraine was allowed to strike Russian territory with Western-made long-range missiles. Ukraine's President Zelensky has been urging allies to allow him to hit military targets inside Russia. Sir Keir has arrived in Washington, where he'll discuss the issue with President Biden later today. It's been reported that Russia has revoked the accreditation of 6 British diplomats, accusing them of spying. Russia's Interfax news agency said the State Security Service claimed their activities threatened the country's security. A group of citizens brought together to consider the issue of assisted dying have concluded the law should be changed in England to allow terminally ill adults to end their life if they wish. The citizens' jury backed the idea after hearing arguments that it would allow people to die with dignity. Those against it were worried about a lack of safeguards. The Nuffield Council on Bioethics, which commissioned the study, said it represented a crucial new piece of evidence in the debate on the issue. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for the White House, has ruled out holding another US presidential debate with his Democratic rival Kamala Harris. Some analysts believe Mr. Trump fared poorly in Tuesday's televised encounter, but he told supporters in Arizona that he had clearly won the debate. The government has confirmed that a ban on junk food adverts being shown on television before 9pm will come into force from the 1st of October next year. Boris Johnson committed to the ban in 2021 when he was Prime Minister, but delayed its start date to give the industry more time to prepare. Tens of thousands of workers at the US plane maker Boeing have voted overwhelmingly to go on strike in a dispute about pay at its plant in Seattle. The walkout, which is due to begin within hours, is another setback for the company after a number of incidents, including in January this year when a door panel blew off a 737 MAX aircraft.
Jane, thank you very much indeed, Jane. Today's meeting between Keir Starmer and President Biden at the White House may lead to a formal decision to allow Ukraine to strike deep into Russia with the missiles it has been supplied by allies. And that means fighting Russia, President Putin has said in comments to a reporter in Russia. Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, joins us. Frank, what do you make of the detail of President Putin's comments, particularly him saying that only servicemen of NATO countries will be able to input flight missions into these missile systems?
Yeah, I mean, look, it all comes down to whether you think President Putin is bluffing or not. There's an argument to make that all his red lines have amounted to nothing, that every time he has said, look, if you send main battle tanks to Ukraine, that is a step towards war, it's an escalation. He didn't do anything. The same with long-range artillery, the same with the F-16s. there are hardliners, the Siloviki, the hard men in Moscow, who are pushing him to take tougher action. And there's a whole broad spectrum, Michel, of measures that he could do, ranging from the mild, expelling diplomats, accusing them of being spies, possibly helping the Houthis in Yemen to target Western warships, to things that are much more dangerous, such as targeting the bases in Poland, for example, where equipment comes through from NATO to supply Ukraine. That would invoke Article 5, and that really would mean that NATO was at war with Russia. I don't think he wants to do that. He will try and do stuff that is sub-threshold, hybrid warfare, things that are just below actually committing forces to warfare.
But it does sound as if Ukraine being able to use these long-range missiles in the way it would like to could well make a material difference to the war, and that's why President Putin is reacting to the prospect in the way that he is.
Well, there is that argument, certainly. So the Institute for Study of War, for example, which is a Washington-based think tank, they've looked at the map and they have identified around 200 Russian bases which would be within range of Storm Shadow, even more if the US allows the use of something called ATACMS, that's the Army Tactical Missile System, which has got a range of about 190 miles, 300 kilometers, as opposed to 155 miles. But it would certainly improve Ukraine's position. I don't think it would win the war for it. It could possibly hasten the end of the war. That's the argument in favor of allowing this. But it's a dangerous move because the US needs to approve its involvement in the targeting that is associated with British Storm Shadow and the French Scalp missiles, as well as, of course, ATACMS. And that is a form of escalation, but it's self-defense for Ukraine. It's trying to stop the absolutely incessant daily bombardment of Ukrainian cities and infrastructure with these terrible glide bombs that are launched from air bases inside Russia that are devastating Ukrainian cities.
Frank, thank you very much.
It is 25 to 7. Let's have a look at some of the front pages of the papers, and quite a few of them. And it is on the front page of the Financial Times, reporting that the Prime Minister's purse was stolen at a police conference amid early prisoner release, as the FT puts it. So Dame Diana Johnson giving a speech to the Police Superintendents Association. It was actually on Tuesday in a 4-star hotel, they say, outside Kenilworth in the West Midlands. Warwickshire police saying they've arrested a 56-year-old man in connection with the purse's theft, adding that he was arrested on suspicion of burglary and been released on bail. The Home Office confirming Dame Diana had her belongings stolen at the conference. No security risks have been identified, they say. The conference was for senior police officers, though, and neither they nor Dame Diana herself are making any further comment.
The Guardian reports that the Israeli army has launched an investigation into allegations in the Israeli media that the London-based Jewish Chronicle published stories based on fabricated intelligence relating to Hamas amid claims that they may have been planted as part of a disinformation campaign. They include the suggestion last week that the Hamas leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, might be preparing to flee to Iran with Israeli hostages. A suggestion has also been made by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The IDF spokesman has said he was unaware of any intelligence to such effect. The Jewish Chronicle, while it still had the stories on its website yesterday, the Guardian says, has also released a statement that says an investigation is underway. There will be an update in due course, and also saying it's always maintained the highest standards of reporting and integrity.
23 minutes to 7 is the time. A so-called citizen's jury has suggested that the law on assisted dying should be changed. Fergus Walsh is our medical editor. Who is this, Fergus? How were they selected?
So this is they were set up by the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, which was a research body, which said it wanted to present to policymakers the reasons why the majority of people consistently in polls say they support assisted dying. So they chose a 30-strong panel, of 28 of whom eventually voted, to reflect the sort of ethnic and background and diversity of the adult population in England, but also, some would say crucially, to reflect the views that people have about assisted dying. So a majority of the people going in already thought assisted dying should be legalised.
And the point being then that the richness, as it were, of their conversations and the thinking that it exposed is itself an important part of this debate.
Yeah, so they spent 8 weeks hearing evidence from experts, from campaign groups, and at the end of it, they voted by roughly 3-1 in favour of the law being changed to allow terminally ill adults with mental capacity to be allowed to have an assisted death, either through self-administering the lethal dose or a doctor administering it for them. And the main motivations were to stop pain, to die with dignity, and feeling that there should be a right to end your life. But there was a minority who were very concerned about this being misused without adequate safeguards, and near universal support that there should be more money for palliative care.
And there will be concern, won't there, among those who oppose assisted dying, that this is part of a kind of broader cultural campaign, I suppose, in a sense to soften us all up for the idea that it is inevitable.
Absolutely. And campaign groups who are opposed are appalled at this. And they say effectively that it was rigged. In terms of where we are with the law, the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, who you'll remember back in 2015, was one of a minority of MPs who voted in favour of the law being changed. He's promised to give MPs a free vote on this at some point in this parliament. There is a private members bill already on the books at Westminster. There's another one at Holyrood. So there is a direction of travel here, but MPs at Westminster and MSPs in Scotland will get free votes on this.
Fergus Walsh, our medical editor. Thank you.
Our main news this morning, Sir Keir Starmer's arrived in Washington to meet President Biden. They will discuss Vladimir Putin's warning that allowing Ukraine to use long-range Western weapons in Russia will risk a wider war.
There was a high political temperature yesterday in Parliament when MPs debated the latest report into the state of the NHS, which warned that the health service in England was in a critical condition. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, delivered the government's first response to the damning report in a speech in London before flying to Washington. Unlike his boss, the Health Secretary wasn't on a diplomatic mission. When he arrived in the Commons to make a statement about the review, Wes Streeting accused the Conservatives of neglecting the NHS. The 9-week investigation was carried out by the surgeon and former Health Minister, Lord Darzi.
I told Lord Darzi we wanted hard truths, warts and all. His findings are raw, honest and breathtaking. He says, and I quote, "Although I have worked in the NHS for more than 30 years, I have been shocked by what I have found."
Wes Streeting said the report had found long waits for care and poor survival rates for cancer, highlighted a decade of underinvestment and criticised controversial changes introduced by the coalition government. And it said the pandemic had hit the NHS harder than any comparable healthcare system in the world.
In other words, Mr. Speaker, it's not just that the Conservatives didn't fix the roof while the sun was shining. They doused the house in petrol, left the gas on, and COVID just lit the match. That's why waiting lists have ballooned to 7.6 million long today.
A short time earlier, the Prime Minister had announced that the government would publish a 10-year plan for the health service. Sir Keir Starmer said he wanted the NHS to move from being an analogue to a digital service, shift care from hospitals to the community, and focus more on prevention. The Conservative Shadow Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, didn't think much of Wes Streeting's bedside manner.
The NHS belongs to us all, and we all care about it. So let's stop the political posturing. and talk constructively about its future.
She said there was much to be proud of in the NHS and defended the previous government's record.
We on this side of the House have never pretended that everything was fixed. We haven't pretended that we have the monopoly on wisdom and or that there are easy answers to the difficult challenges we face.
But the Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, accused the Conservatives of leaving hospitals in a dire state.
Today's report is a scathing summary of the complete devastation that the Conservatives have wrought on our health services and on the health of our communities. We Liberal Democrats have long argued that we need to shift healthcare from hospital to high streets and from treatment to prevention, because doing so improves health outcomes and it saves taxpayers' money. So it's a win-win.
That brought a change in the Health Secretary's tone, as he said it was refreshing to have constructive opposition in the Commons.
And it was clear throughout the election campaign, actually, that my party and the Liberal Democrats have much in common, both in terms of commitments we made, which were in some cases identical.
Before the election, the Labour MP Peter Prinsley worked as a surgeon.
Hundreds of thousands of operations, including dozens of my own lists, were cancelled due to the strikes in the NHS over the last 3 years. Does the Secretary of State agree that the Conservatives' refusal to negotiate with the doctors contributed to the terrible state of the health service? And that ending the strikes is really the first step to fix the NHS?
I'm grateful for that intervention, Madam Deputy Speaker, and I can tell you, it really sticks in the craw to hear the carping and criticism from the party opposite and the obvious bitter resentment that we were able to do in 3 weeks what they failed to do in over a year.
The longest-serving member of the Commons, the father of the House, Sir Edward Lee, a Conservative, thought Wes Streeting should take a look at health services in other countries.
Particularly the Netherlands and Australia, France and Germany, which, whilst protecting the vulnerable and having wonderful health systems, have a mixture of social insurance, public and private, to maximise inputs into the health service. We'll at least look at these models.
And Richard Tice of Reform UK said everyone agreed that the NHS needed to change.
The levels of waste, bureaucracy and mismanagement are legendary. Indeed, this report specifically refers to the huge quantities of regulators, accountants, bureaucrats, top down.
Wes Streeting said the government would work to reduce the burden of regulation and free NHS staff from red tape.
Sean Curran reporting. Well, as the report was launched, the Prime Minister said one area where there had to be more ambition was on children's dentistry. He was shocked, he said, to see at one hospital that the biggest cause of children between 6 and 10 being admitted was to have rotting teeth taken out. Junk food adverts are now to be banned online and on TV until 9 p.m. But a report out today calls for radical action on oral health because tooth decay in children is at staggering levels. Paula Waterhouse was until yesterday the president of the British Society of Paediatric Dentistry and was involved with this report. Paula Waterhouse, what would radical action to you look like?
Good morning, Michelle. We do have a crisis in children's oral health. I think that's clear. And as you said, you know, tooth decay is the most common reason for hospital admission in 5 to 9 year olds. And over half the children in England have not seen an NHS dentist in the past 12 months. So something needs to happen here to improve the oral health of our children and young people. And it's more pronounced in certain areas. So for children who reside in the most deprived areas of England, they are 2.5 times more likely to have tooth decay. And that just is not fair. These children, through no fault of their own, have tooth decay. And we need to work with multi-agencies to try and produce a strategy to start making inroads into this and making improvements in the oral health of children.
What would you put in that strategy? We know about the teeth brushing in schools. We know about this junk food advertising ban that is coming in. What else would you do?
Okay. Well, British Society of Paediatric Dentistry's priorities are that all children should have a dental home. And by that, we mean that all children should have an ongoing relationship with an oral healthcare provider. And evidence shows, particularly in this report, the evidence is really robust to say that we need a shift towards much more of an emphasis on prevention around preventing dental disease. And our key asks, if you will, we can boil down to four areas, two of which you've mentioned already. We need a robust strategy that will work. And we need to address sugars, fluoride, and access to dental care. And a development of a child oral health strategy should involve many different agencies, carers, the dental profession, education, medical colleagues, health visitors. And it needs to be a national strategy, but also suitable for local areas. And we need to look at reducing the amount of sugar our children eat and drink. We perhaps all need to be looking at the amount of sugar that we eat and drink, but it's so important to be doing that, as you mentioned earlier. We need to also ensure that children get fluoride to protect their teeth from an early age. And
put it in the water, really, you mean?
Pardon?
Put it in the water, which is not done in, it's done in very few areas, local authority areas.
You're right. That is absolutely correct. No, what I'm meaning by that is instigating early years toothbrushing programs, supervised toothbrushing programs in early year settings and educational settings to get toothbrushing a regular part of, you know, routine day, and to get the fluoride onto the baby teeth and the young adult teeth to start protecting them from an early stage.
Paula Waterhouse, thank you very much.
10 to 7 is the time. Back at home, we all have a lot of work to do, said the billionaire businessman Jared Isaacman. But from here, Earth sure looks like a perfect world. He was speaking after stepping out into space, the first private space walk, which he achieved in conjunction with Elon Musk's SpaceX company. Let's talk to James Brugger, who's co-founder of one of the world's leading space investment companies, Seraphim. Mr. Brugger, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
I mean, it's tempting to look at this as a billionaire, a lot of time in his hand, a lot of money in his pocket. Who cares? But I think you're going to say we should care, and it really matters.
Indeed. I think there's a lot of misconceptions because it is these billionaires such as Elon Musk and Jared Isaacman, Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson who tend to grab the headlines about their efforts in space. And certainly they have pioneered, but where they have led, many, many others have followed. And the sort of innovation that we're seeing in space has a direct and profound impact on all of our lives back here on Earth.
Which is what?
Oh, it's very multifaceted. So to start with, you're seeing over the last decade, dramatic reductions in the cost of being able to put things into space, and the cost of developing those technologies. So you are now seeing for the first time constellations of hundreds, if not thousands, of miniaturized satellites that are now blanketing the Earth with internet connectivity, helping the third of the world's population that still can't get online reliably be able to connect to the internet, as well as helping combat some of our most pressing challenges, including those of climate change. It's only really from space that we're able to collect the data to help us monitor and indeed mitigate the worst ravages of climate change.
And it's interesting that NASA have welcomed this and said it's very much part of the future. It is, isn't it? I mean, the private exploitation of space and development of space is the big thing now, rather than the government doing it, because simply we haven't got the money.
Indeed, this has been one of the most significant changes in recent decades, albeit worth noting that the private sector has always had a significant role to play in space. But you are now seeing the likes of Elon Musk, SpaceX and many others delivering and services on behalf of governments at a fraction of the cost that those governments have been able to do before. So you've seen telecommunications, you've seen intelligence gathering, you've seen rocket launches. And now you're seeing space exploration itself, as well as various initiatives around the moon, where it is very much the private sector, including relatively small companies, that are at the forefront of these developments.
How soon till it becomes commonplace?
I think it's going to be quite a while before the likes of you and I consider taking a holiday.
Just checking.
I think that's a little way off. But look, I think yesterday was a really momentous occasion, and you are going to see increasing numbers of people going into orbit over the course of the next decade. But I still think it's likely to be in modest numbers, and I still think it will, for the time being, most likely be dominated by space agency astronauts from various countries.
James Brugger from Seraphim, thank you very much.
7 minutes to seven, Israel has said that three of those killed in Wednesday's strike on a school in Gaza were Hamas members who were also working for the UN agency UNRWA. The UN called the strike a violation of international humanitarian law, and UNRWA said none of the names highlighted by Israel now were on a previous Israeli list of staff alleged to be Hamas members. I've been speaking to Sam Rose, Senior Deputy Director of UNRWA in Gaza, who will be seeing the school for himself today.
The building is built for a kind of primary school in this part of the world. It's a three-story building built around a courtyard, classrooms all around it, a playground in the middle. But since October, I mean, this school, along with more than 100 other UNRWA schools, has been acting as an emergency shelter. At the time of the attack, the school was hosting about 12,000 people. People separate themselves into families, sheltering in classrooms, sometimes sheltering in the courtyard, in the quadrangle, in the front of the school, underneath tented sheets, underneath tarpaulin. There are rooms set aside for distribution. We keep supplies in there, whether this is mattresses, food, hygiene materials. We were also, particularly in this school, we were preparing a room to get kids back to learning, that we were looking to set that up.
Israel says that it was targeting members of Hamas's armed wing, and indeed it is said that three of the six UNRWA staff who died were members of Hamas's armed wing. Can you say for sure that that is not the case and that the premises were not being used for extremist activity?
I mean, we have no evidence to the effect that those premises were being used for extremist activity. We have no evidence either that the staff were doing what Israel says they were doing. We provide names of all our staff to the Israeli authorities regularly. At no time had the names that have appeared on the statements that have been issued by the Israeli army ever been flagged to us as UNRWA as concerns. I mean, what we can say is that this school was housing, you know, thousands upon thousands of civilians. Very, very crowded, very, very cramped. Many of the classrooms that I referred to earlier, we have, you know, sheltering 20, 30, 40 people. Munitions used in these types of situations, it's inevitable that they will cause casualties. And this is what happened on this occasion. It's what's happened on previous occasions. We've got 300 schools, as I say, in Gaza. Around two-thirds of them have been hit during conflicts. I mean, conflicts are dehumanizing by their very nature, but they have rules. And we continue to insist upon all parties to the conflict, that's Israel, and in this case, it's Hamas and Palestinian factions, to respect those rules of war and to respect the civilian character of UN buildings, including our schools.
But even in the last few days, it's not the only incident involving UN staff. There was an incident at a checkpoint of staff who were going to work on the polio vaccination. There was also an Israeli strike this week on what's normally described as a humanitarian area.
The strikes and these incidents, they're coming so thick and fast that they're almost too difficult to comprehend and get our heads around. Monday night of this week, we had teams of UN professionals, our national staff and international staffs, heading to northern Gaza through an Israeli checkpoint to lead on the polio vaccination campaign. They were held up for several hours. Staff whose movements, whose names had been cleared in advance by the Israeli authorities, was subject to a harrowing assault. The following day, there was a strike in what appears to be using, you know, heavy munitions that hit a quote unquote safe zone that Palestinian civilians had been ordered and instructed to move to by the Israeli authorities because it was safe. And we are getting to the point where it's increasingly difficult to guarantee that the safety of our staff.
Sam Rose of UNRWA in Gaza. Thank you.
It is 3 minutes to seven. Time for the weather. Stavda Nails is here.
Thanks very much, Justin and Michelle. Good morning to you. High pressure is moving in now. It's cutting off the Arctic northerly airflow, and it will replace it with a milder southwesterly breeze as we head into the weekend. So temperatures will recover back to the seasonal norm for many, but it will turn a bit wet and windy this weekend for northern and western areas. Into next week, though, high pressure holds on, so it should be mostly settled and dry with temperatures around or indeed a little above the seasonal norm. Today, though, we're starting off on a chilly note. England, Scotland and Wales, it is cold out there. Temperatures down to minus one Celsius in Estelle Muir. So it's one of the coldest starts this early in September for quite a number of years. So a little bit of mist here and there, mist and fog patches, in fact. But it will be a dry and sunny morning for the vast majority. Cloud will bubble up into the afternoon, could see the odd light shower developing, but most places will stay dry. And there is just the chance of a few coastal showers, eastern England and northwest Scotland, most favoured for these. Winds will remain very light for all. Northern Ireland, also a cold start for you. The odd shower peppering northern and western coast. Otherwise, this is a bright morning with some sunshine before skies turn grey and cloudy this afternoon, along with a freshening southerly breeze here. Temperatures today will range across the UK, will range from 11 to 14 degrees for Scotland and Northern Ireland, and 13 to 17 Celsius for England and Wales. So we're a couple of degrees up on yesterday.
Stav, thank you very much. Later today, how the CIA was born.
On BBC Radio 4.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
A major new audio drama.
Can't just call them, can we?
About the birth of the CIA.
They can't publicly sanction a covert plan to influence the result of a foreign election.
Starring Ed Harris, Johnny Flynn, and me, Kim Cattrall.
I'd love to be a spy.
Secrets, lies, covert operations.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
It's about the CIA, but not as you know it.
Do you want to work in intelligence or espionage?
What's the difference?
Central Intelligence starts this afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Among the subjects we'll be covering in the next hour on this programme, adverts for junk food going to be banned online completely, it seems, and on TV after 9 o'clock. Is it going to make a difference? The chef Hugh Fernley-Whittingstall will be making the case. Plus Steve Rosenberg on the return of Soviet-era denunciations across Russia.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 13th of September. The headlines this morning. Keir Starmer has arrived in Washington ahead of talks with President Biden. They will discuss Vladimir Putin's warning that allowing Ukraine to strike Russia with Western weapons risks a wider war. A citizen's jury has said the law on assisted dying in England should be changed to allow terminally ill adults to end their life if they wish. And there's to be a ban on TV adverts for junk food before the watershed. Ministers say it will be brought in next year. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has arrived in Washington for talks with President Biden after the Russian leader issued his starkest warning yet about the dangers of loosening restrictions on the use of weapons supplied by the West. President Putin said that Europe and the United States would be in direct conflict with Moscow if they allowed Kiev to attack Russian territory with long-range Western missiles. In response, Sakir stressed Ukraine's right to self-defence. Our first report is from our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, in Moscow.
President Putin made it clear that if the West lifts restrictions on Ukraine using long-range Western missiles to strike Russian territory, he would treat that as the direct participation of NATO countries in the war in Ukraine. That would, he said, substantially change the nature of the conflict and mean that NATO states would be fighting Russia. The Kremlin leader indicated that Moscow would take appropriate decisions based on the threats created. He provided no specific details of how Russia might respond. But Vladimir Putin is clearly raising the stakes.
Mr. Putin's latest threat, as well as whether to strengthen Ukraine's hand, will be high on the agenda when the Prime Minister meets Joe Biden. Our political editor, Chris Mason, who's been travelling with Sir Keir Starmer, sent this report from Washington.
This is Sir Keir Starmer's second visit to the White House in 2 months. Ukraine's allies still remain rather guarded in their public remarks about a change in policy on the use of Western missiles inside Russia. But the diplomatic dashing to arrive at a decision is in plain sight. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Foreign Secretary David Lammy in Kyiv this week, Mr. Lammy telling The Telegraph it was vital to understand how we can put Ukrainians in a position to win and what is needed. The Prime Minister's in Washington today, the annual UN General Assembly's in New York the week after next. There are really important developments likely in the next few weeks and months, and therefore a number of tactical decisions ought to be taken, the Prime Minister told us. He was more direct in his response to Vladimir Putin's threats. Russia started this, he said. Moscow caused the conflict and it could stop it.
Russia's Interfax news agency is reporting that the State Security Service has revoked the accreditation of six British diplomats, accusing them of espionage. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner has this assessment of how Moscow could react if Western countries give Ukraine permission to use long-range weapons to attack Russian soil.
Is Vladimir Putin bluffing? That's the calculation that strategic planners and elected leaders in Washington and other Western capitals now have to make. Those in favour of allowing Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia argue that so far in this war, none of his so-called red lines have amounted to anything. The Russian leader hinted at retaliation if the West supplied Ukraine with main battle tanks, with long-range artillery, and then with F-16 warplanes. Each time, nothing happened. Mr. Putin already believes his country to be at war with NATO in all but name. So, some argue, what difference would this make? But if Russia did retaliate this time, then it has a broad spectrum of options short of declaring war. At the milder end of the spectrum, it could launch so-called sub-threshold attacks, such as cyber attacks, interfering with undersea cables, or sending drones to disrupt Western air traffic. Other, far more dangerous but less likely options would include detonating a tactical nuclear warhead against Ukraine or attacking a Western supply base inside a NATO country like Poland. And those scenarios are exactly what Washington is desperate to avoid.
The first citizens' jury on assisted dying in England has said the law should be changed to allow terminally ill adults to have help to end their lives. The research group, the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, commissioned the study to explore public views. It chose jury members to be representative of the population, which meant most were already in favour of assisted dying. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
The 30-member jury, of whom 28 voted, spent 8 weeks hearing evidence from experts and campaigners. Jurors voted by 3-1 in favour of assisted dying being available to those with a terminal condition who have the capacity to make their own decisions. Key motivations for supporting a change in the law were to stop pain and knowing that you could die with dignity. Those against were worried it could be misused without adequate safeguards. There was near universal support for more funding for palliative care. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has promised to give MPs a free vote on assisted dying at some point, with private members' bills already introduced at Westminster and at the Scottish Parliament, Holyrood.
More than 30,000 workers at the aerospace giant Boeing are to go on strike after overwhelmingly rejecting a new pay offer, which was backed by their own union. The industrial action will affect Boeing's major production sites in Washington and Oregon. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
This is a severe blow to Boeing and an embarrassment for its new chief executive, Kelly Ortberg. The company had described the new contract offer, which would have provided a pay increase of 25% over 4 years, as historic. The emphatic rejection, with 96% of those polled voting for strike action, has exposed a deep rift between Boeing's management and a powerful section of its workforce. This comes at a time when the aerospace giant is already wrestling with a serious safety and quality control crisis. The strike will affect some of the company's most important facilities, including factories where the 737 MAX and the 777 are built. Analysts say an extended shutdown could cost the company and its suppliers billions of dollars.
The Prime Minister has said the government didn't carry out an impact assessment on cutting winter fuel support for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. The Conservatives had called for any such reports to be published. But Sir Keir Starmer told journalists he hadn't been shown any analysis about taking away the winter fuel payment from older people who do not receive pension credit. The government has confirmed that a ban on junk food adverts being shown on television before 9 p.m. will come into force from the 1st of October next year. The then Prime Minister Boris Johnson committed to the ban in 2021, but delayed its start date. Our correspondent Vincent McAvinney has more.
The Royal Society for Public Health has welcomed Labour's confirmation of a junk food advertising ban, describing it as key to building a healthier future for the next generation. The policy, which was in Labour's manifesto, will not only see junk food advertising stopped on TV before the watershed, but also a total ban on paid-for online adverts to tackle childhood obesity. The Health Minister, Andrew Gwynn, says that more than one in five children in England are overweight or obese by the time they start primary school, rising to more than a third by the time they leave.
The Duke of Sussex has told the BBC he was anxious about turning 30, but is excited about turning 40 this weekend. He'll spend his birthday on Sunday privately with family in California, before heading off on a weekend away with close friends. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
His 30s have been a turbulent decade for the Duke of Sussex. He's become a husband and a father, split acrimoniously from the royal family, stopped being a working royal and moved to California. But he appears to be approaching his 40th with a sense of positivity. In a statement, Prince Harry told the BBC he was anxious at 30, but is excited about 40, with a mission to continue doing good. He spoke about his children, Archie and Lilibet, saying that becoming a father had given him a fresh perspective, describing it as one of life's greatest joys that had made him more committed to making the world a better place. The statement ended on an optimistic note from Prince Harry. Bring on the next decade, he said.
Daniela Ralph reporting.
Jane, thank you very much. The time is 9 minutes past seven. It is hold your nerve time. The Prime Minister will be at the White House later today to talk about Ukraine and long-range weapons, just as Vladimir Putin spells out why he thinks giving Ukraine what it wants on the use of those weapons amounts to NATO fighting Russia. This morning, Russia's security services have said that it was revoking the accreditation of six British diplomats in Moscow, whose actions, it said, showed signs of spying and sabotage. There's been no official British response as yet. But early this morning, I spoke to our political editor, Chris Mason, who is travelling with the Prime Minister to Washington.
I think this is a key meeting, but one of a sequence of meetings. So we're seeing the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, the President of the United States, all involved in these conversations, and others too. And we seem to be inching ever closer towards that authorisation being given for the use of these Western missiles, considerably some distance into Russia. And at the moment, publicly, we have language that is cautious, that is guarded, that is non-committal. And then privately, you have, and you can hear, a strategic dilemma. There's a reason why this hasn't happened so far in this conflict, and that's because of a concern of escalation. We've heard the response from Vladimir Putin. And yes, there seems to be a growing sense that because of the additional support that Russia has had from Iran, that there needs to be a counter to that, and there is a long winter coming up. But even when all of that's factored in, you come back to that strategic dilemma and that attempt to try and read the mind of the Russian president. How might he respond if these missiles are deployed?
Because publicly, what he says is very stark indeed, that changing the use or the rules around the use of these Western arms by Ukraine would substantially change the nature of the conflict, and NATO states would be fighting Russia.
Yes, and his argument is this. He says, look, there is a significant difference between NATO countries giving Ukraine, for instance, a tank or tanks, and them being used even in Russian territory, because they are solely under the command and the operation of the Ukrainians. His argument is, if you are deploying technology as advanced as these missiles, then the controlling hand, if you like, stretches well beyond Kyiv and well beyond Ukraine. So he is making an argument that that means that NATO countries would be drawn into a direct involvement in the conflict. And therefore, the question's posed, isn't it? What might he do in response? Now, yes, so far in this conflict, he has often uttered rhetoric which has been pretty strong, and that hasn't always been matched by a similar amount of action, if you like. But the dilemma is, who knows this time?
Mm. And you talked directly to the Prime Minister on the plane about this, didn't you? I mean, he essentially was responding to what President Putin has said.
He was absolutely responding directly to it and was pretty robust, actually. You know, he's a Prime Minister who's only been in office for a couple of months and is suddenly in a position where, yeah, of course, he has to weight his language, particularly in the international sphere, so carefully. And it was striking how robust he was. He said repeatedly that Moscow had started this, that they had illegally invaded Ukraine, that they could stop this war straight away if they wanted to. And actually, what was striking, Michelle, was the contrast between how robust he was in that condemnation of Vladimir Putin. Not surprising, but nonetheless, it was robust. Well, whilst publicly picking his language carefully on this ongoing conversation around the weapons, not least because he will be aware, yes, there are conversations still to continue, but one, from his perspective, overused description or bit of language could provoke, you know, yet more of a verbal response from the Kremlin.
Chris Mason, thank you.
It is 13 minutes past seven. A ban on junk food advertising before 9 o'clock in the evening on the TV and at all times online. It's a big move from the government. What does it actually mean? What impact might it have? Hugh Friendly Whittingstall is on the line, the celebrity chef, writer, broadcaster. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And backer of this, I guess, and you'll be pleased.
Very much so. But I'm just one of a whole raft of campaigners and NGOs who've been on this case for the best part of a decade, more in some cases. So it's fantastic to finally see action and to have a government who looks like they accept the idea that it is part of their role to help us to lead healthier lives. They have not got this kind of built-in ideological opposition to the idea of looking after their population and helping us stay well.
What is your definition, and indeed do you understand what the government's definition is going to be of junk food?
Well, that's never completely straightforward, but we can look at very specific things like levels of salt and sugar and fat in foods. And we can get to a definition, just as we have for levels of sugar in implementing the sugar tax, which, by the way, has been genuinely successful in reducing the sugar intake through fizzy drinks, which is significant. But in the end, this is just one of a raft of measures that we need to see. There are, in the past, we've identified so many vital levers that could be pulled to help people, particularly young people, live healthier lives, reduce the huge burden of obesity on the NHS. And this is a lever that even the previous government acknowledged needed to be pulled, but there are other urgent levers. And we can't really have a coherent conversation about the future of the NHS unless tackling obesity is at the heart of it, because it's the single biggest cause of preventable illness, of early death, and it's the single biggest expense of any disease, and living with obesity is a disease, for the NHS. So this is just one step among many that need to be taken, but it's extremely welcome.
Would you add, you mentioned salt and sugar, and that's a pretty obvious thing, because you can kind of measure, can't you, salt and sugar in particular foods. What about the whole category of ultra-processed foods that we've heard a lot about in recent years, and the food industry is heavily involved with, and does us harm, probably going further than obesity, doesn't it? Would you include those as well?
Well, I'd certainly include them in measures like labelling. We need clear front of pack labelling. And in fact, the British Heart Foundation came out last week to say that for them, this is one of the biggest issues. Clear labelling about what's in food, clear indications of certain processed ingredients that in the long term contribute to ill health, so people can make informed decisions. I mean, the triple whammy of really tackling obesity is labelling and taxation and the restriction of advertising. And it isn't just about punishing the fast food companies and the companies that make ultra processed foods. It's about encouraging them to reformulate so that more of their foods actually fall on the right side of these definitions and the legislation, so that fast food companies can go on advertising their products, even to children, if they're healthy enough. And we need to get more fiber into these foods. We need to reduce salt and sugar, and in some cases, reduce fat. And reformulation of these, because, you know, we're not going to make processed food go away anytime soon, but the formula for these foods can be improved, and they can particularly be improved by reducing the harmful ingredients and increasing the beneficial ingredients of things like fiber, which do make a genuine contribution, a lasting contribution to improving our health.
Hugh Fernley-Whittingstall, thank you very much.
17 minutes past seven. There has been a merger planned, announced between two mobile phone companies, Vodafone and Three, and the Competition and Markets Authority has just said that it could mean millions of customers paying more. Felicity Hanna has more now.
Yes, I do. This is the provisional view from the CMA on the planned merger. It will make its final decision by December the 7th. It says there are competition concerns over the plan and that it's now going to explore potential solutions. Stuart McIntosh is Independent Inquiry Chair for the CMA and joins me now. Stuart, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
What are your concerns then about the deal in terms of what customers might pay?
Well, between them, Vodafone and Three have over 27 million customers, and we're concerned that the merger will push up customer bills and that prices across the market will increase as well as a result of the reduction in competition. Now, as you said, Vodafone and Three say that the merger will actually increase competition because of the investments they would make in their network, particularly in their new 5G infrastructure, and that this would provide big improvements in the quality of mobile services. And we agree to some extent, but we're not convinced that the merged company will actually follow through fully with the investments they're talking about, or that the benefits of the merger would be as great as they claim. So today we are setting out our findings and analysis and consultation, and we're also consulting on potential solutions like legally binding investment commitments and the sort of measures that might be taken in order to protect customers in both the retail market and the wholesale market.
Now, the wholesale concerns are interesting as well. So you're worried about it pushing up what customers might pay, but you're also concerned it might reduce competition for those wholesale telecoms customers who use the big networks to provide their own mobile services.
That's right. I mean, your listeners may not understand, but companies like Lebara, ID Mobile, Sky Mobile, they buy network services from one of the four network operators. And if the merger goes through, that four would be reduced to three, which would reduce their options, less competition, more pressure on prices. And we're particularly concerned about this because those wholesale providers, they're called mobile virtual network operators, very often focus on the value end of the market. So they're providing very good value services to customers who are perhaps not able to afford to pay high prices. So that would be a particular concern for us.
Now, Vodafone and Three have pledged £11 billion to upgrade and expand their 5G network as part of this merger. Is there a risk that your concerns over competition actually damage outcomes for consumers in the longer term?
Well, that's obviously not our intention. I mean, what we're looking here to understand is what the merger would do in the market and whether or not that would put pressure on prices and services in other ways. And it's important to realise that, I mean, this industry as a whole invests about £2.5 to £3 billion per annum, according to the industry regulator, Ofcom. We would expect investment to continue in the future. But as I said earlier on, we're also interested in exploring whether there are solutions to the competition problems that we've identified that potentially would allow us to clear this merger and for those benefits that Vodafone and Three are putting forward to be realised.
Now, these two companies, they're the third and the fourth largest players in this field. They say merging is essential to drive that investment and also to compete against the two even bigger companies, BT and Virgin Media O2.
We see both of these companies competing very strongly in the market, both between themselves and across the market as a whole against EE and O2. So I think we see that competition continuing. And one of our concerns regarding the merger, were it to go ahead, one of the important players in the market potentially would disappear.
Stuart McIntosh, the independent inquiry chair for the CMA, thank you very much. Now, as you would expect, the Vodafone disagree with the CMA's provisional findings, and their chief executive will be talking to Justin at about 8:30.
Thank you, Fliss. 7:22. The first citizens' jury on assisted dying in England has backed a change in the law to allow people who are terminally ill to end their life under some circumstances. A jury of 28 people concluded it should be given as an option for those judged to have capacity to make their own decisions. It doesn't have any legal power, but the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, which set up the jury, says it represents a crucial new piece of evidence in the debate, as it allows the public to consider the issues more deeply than they normally would in a survey. And Daniel Hamm is here, who's the director of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, and Ashok Kumar as well, who was a member of the jury. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Tell us first about how it was selected, Daniel.
So this citizens' jury provides the missing piece of evidence in the conversation about assisted dying. It provides evidence of a public judgment of a group of representative people of the British public. So in terms of how it was selected, we balloted 7,000 households across England, asking if members, adult members of the household, would be willing to take part in this citizens' jury. And then of those who agreed, we mapped the demographic, if you like, of the jury against ONS data. So it's broadly representative of people's age, ethnicity, educational status, and also their attitudes to assisted dying.
Oh, well, that's the crucial thing, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people who oppose assisted dying will say, hang on a second, the word jury isn't really applicable, because a jury in a court of law go into a court case, don't they, without any presuppositions at all about what is right and what is wrong, what actually happened. They listen to evidence. In your case, you have people on the jury who already had, albeit not necessarily very strongly, but a point of view.
So, citizens' jury is recognised as a credible tool for engaging citizens on a wide range of issues. And it's a credible tool because it's a mini public. So the group of people in that room are broadly representative of the population. And that includes attitudes to the issue in question, as well as the demographic information. So if you walked into a room of 30 people, you wouldn't find 30 neutral or undecided people.
Right, that's your point, isn't it? So you're basically reflecting a room of 30 people and what you would expect to be the attitude to assisting dying.
Exactly.
Okay. And when it comes to the conversations, Ashok Kumar, what did you actually do?
We had a panel discussion, and we had all the information put together, and then we were drawing from the personal experience and the professional experience to benefit a larger whole. It was incredibly a wonderful experience. The panel discussions involve people from varied walks of life, including the doctors, lawyers, and general public. So they have given us different views for us to look into a bird-eye view of the problem.
And did you hear from those who are opposed to assisted dying?
We did, yes.
And they were allowed to try to convince you, were they, as a jury, that you should change what seems to be the broad overall mind of the jury when you started off?
I think I came with a one-dimensional view, which predominantly looking at, I'm on the fence, looking at analysing the problem critically. It was important to look into what are the issues for and against assisted dying. So it was really important for us to critically reflect and see which is best, and then also look into everybody's views.
Did you change your mind at all?
I was on the fence when I came in, and then looking at all the information given to us, and I moved into for making this as a law.
Right, so you moved into the camp of those who think, which is apparently a majority of the population, that in some circumstances assisted dying should be allowed.
That's correct.
And Daniel Hamm, that then brings us to what should happen now and what influence, impact this should have, in your view, in the public debate and indeed in the parliamentary debate when it happens.
Thank you. This is the missing piece of evidence that has been, and it's the missing piece because it provides that really deep nuance around people's judgments and why people have reached that decision. And it gives policymakers the information they need to really fully understand where the British public's attitudes lies. And
also, presumably, the warp and weft of argument about
exactly.
or discussion.
So it's not just what people think, it's why, and their nuanced views, their reasoning, and how they've reached this decision. And we're publishing this interim report now because we know this is a live policy debate across England and the UK more widely. And we hope that this information will be used by decision makers to inform the debate and the conversation on assisted dying.
And if someone does want to see it, how do they, just in a word, what's the easiest way of seeing the whole thing?
To go to our website.
So, and it's the Nuffield Council on Bioethics.
The Nuffield Council on
Bioethics. And it's
all
there now.
And this is the interim report. It's the verbatim findings of the jury. And early next year, we will be providing the full analysis, and there'll be much richness of data that informs people's understanding of how people reach their views.
Danielle
and what's important.
Hamm and Ashok Kumar as well. Thank you both very much.
28 minutes past seven, and Carthy's here with the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. A hearing to examine 115 Premier League charges against Manchester City will now begin on Monday. City were referred to an independent commission by the Premier League in February of 2023 over allegedly breaking the financial rules of the competition. The hearing is expected to run for 10 weeks, but a verdict isn't expected until early 2025. Now, golf's Solheim Cup starts today with Europe, the holders needing 14 points to retain the trophy for a record fourth time, while the USA need 14.5 points to win. I've been speaking to the BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter about who the favourites are this time around.
Well, Carthy, they drew the last match and Europe won the two previous ones. Indeed, America have won only twice since 2009. And yet, they are the favourites. In Nelly Korda and Lilia Vu, they have the top two players in the world. On average, their team is ranked 14 places higher in the world standings. Europe are happy to be the underdogs, though, it must be said. And they've already got under the skin of the hosts with a noisy breakfast as the US team tried to practice in front of the European team house. There's always that capacity for controversy at the Solheim. But America, as I say, are the favourites. President Obama is likely to be in the galleries to watch what the home team are calling unfinished business as they try to wrestle back this trophy for the first time since 2017.
Well, the foursomes are the first matches today. What are the pairings?
Well, for the first time in a Solheim Cup career, Ireland's Leona Maguire is going to miss a session. Europe blood both rookies on this first morning. On debut, Esther Henselite of Germany. She's going to partner Charlie Hull in the top match. That's against the world number one, Nelly Korda and Alison Corpuz. They're followed by the Swiss wildcard rookie, Alban Valenzuela, alongside Celine Boutier against Rose Zhang and Lauren Coughlan. Britain's Georgia Hall, she's going to miss out the opening session. Emily Pedersen is partnering Maya Stark against Ali Ewing and Jennifer Kupcho, with Lynn Grant and Carlotta Seganda up against Lilia Vu and Sarah Smetzel on debut in the crucial bottom match.
Thanks, Ian Carter. Now let's hear from the Team Europe captain, Suzanne Pettersen.
History of the Solheim, after all the golf that's played, it literally comes down to like the one shot or the one putt or the one chip in. It's quite amazing that it's literally that close after all that golf that's been played. So, yeah, fingers crossed. Maybe half a point more than we got in last year's Friday morning session would be great. But, I mean, fair enough. We got outplayed.
There's commentary of day one of the Solheim Cup from 5 o'clock on the BBC Sport website and app and on 5 Live from 8.30. Rory McIlroy is just two shots off the lead of England's Tom Clements after day one of the Irish Open at Royal County Down. The world number three finished his first round with a hat-trick of birdies to card a 3 under 68. Cricket and England take on Australia in the second men's T20 this evening at 6.30. We'll be looking ahead to that later. And Great Britain's Davis Cup tennis team face Argentina today in Manchester. They had a tight 2-1 win in their opening tie against Finland, but captain Leon Smith has asked that the crowd makes more noise to help them take advantage of being at home. And there's commentary of first practice of the Formula One Azerbaijan Grand Prix on 5 Sports Extra from 10.30 this morning. Racing tips are here as we have a big meeting on the calendar. It is the St Leger Festival at Doncaster, 2:25, number 3, Jonquil, and Doncaster 3 o'clock, number 1, Asterius.
Thank you, Carthy.
It's been a summer of spectacular concerts from the BBC Proms. with stunning performances and unique collaborations. Culminating in the world's biggest classical music party. The last night of the proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
Weather. It's going to be bright and chilly for most of us, with sunshine at least at the beginning. Then it's going to turn cloudy through the afternoon. There'll be some rain moving into Northern Ireland and Scotland later. And I distinctly remember hearing Stav saying earlier that it's going to get warmer.
This is pretty comprehensive for this time of the morning.
I do my best.
The time is just after 7:30. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer has said Britain doesn't seek any conflict with Moscow in response to a warning from Vladimir Putin that Russia would be at war with the West if Ukraine was allowed to use their long-range missiles to attack targets within Russia. Sir Keir, who's in Washington, said Ukraine had the right to defend itself. Mr. Putin's latest threat, as well as whether to strengthen Kiev's hand, will be on the agenda when the Prime Minister meets President Biden later. It's been reported that Russia has revoked the accreditation of six British diplomats, accusing them of spying. Russia's Interfax news agency said the State Security Service claimed their activities threatened the country's security. A panel of people selected to reflect the population of England say the law should change to allow terminally ill adults to end their life if they wish. The citizens' jury was set up by the charity the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. It said the study represented a crucial new piece of evidence in the debate on the issue. The jury backed the idea after hearing arguments that it would allow people to die with dignity. Those against it were worried about a lack of safeguards. The Competition and Markets Authority has warned that a proposed merger between the telecoms companies Vodafone and Three could lead to their 27 million customers paying more. The two firms say the £15 billion deal will lead to greater investment. The CMA says it's consulting on whether there should be legally binding investment commitments in order to protect customers if the merger goes ahead. Donald Trump has told supporters that he scored a monumental victory in his US presidential debate against Kamala Harris and, as a result, was ruling out any further televised encounters. He was speaking at his first election rally since the debate on Tuesday, in which some analysts believe Mr. Trump fared poorly. The Metropolitan Police say two men have been charged with burglary after a painting by the artist Banksy was stolen on Sunday. They are Larry Fraser, who's 47, and James Love, who's 53. The painting was taken from a gallery in London.
Jane, thank you very much. It is coming up to 25 to 8. There were some strong words on the programme yesterday, both about part of the Doctors' Union, the BMA, and about GPs, comments that we wanted to explore because in one way or another they amount to accusations of standing in the way of progress, reform and change. GPs in England are currently involved in work to rule action in a dispute with the government over funding. It means some are limiting the number of patients they see to 25 a day. The chair of the BMA GPs committee in England is Dr. Katie Bramall-Stainer, and she's on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Michelle.
Could we begin first with words from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who was on the programme yesterday talking about the Darzi report and the wider questions it raises, and said this.
People are crying out for change, and I have some good conversations with the BMA actually on reform, and I think there's a real possibility, having settled the junior doctors dispute, to rebuild that sense of professional partnership. I contrast that with some of the sabre-rattling we've seen from the BMA's GP committee, where despite the fact we put £100 million into GP unemployment in the first 6 weeks of this government, and our determination to grow primary care and general practice as a proportion of NHS budgets, we still see sabre-rattling, the unnecessary threat of collective action, which, let's be clear, would harm patients and put more burden on their colleagues in other parts of the NHS.
So that is a specific accusation about the committee you lead, the BMA GP committee. What do you say in response?
Well, I heard that yesterday morning, Michelle, and I was disappointed, but I can understand the political subtext behind this. To suggest that we're sabre-rattling, I don't think is going to chime with your listeners, who probably will also have experienced immense changes to their local GP and family doctor service. We have seen, well, we've lost 2,000 practices over the past 15 years. That's 20% of GP surgeries gone. Thousands of GPs have been hemorrhaged from the NHS. One in four GPs knows another GP that has taken their own life. My own GP took his own life in 2021. And that's not saber-rattling. That is because general practice is collapsing now. We're not in a position to be able to wait for long-term plans next year or consumer spending reviews. Our action isn't striking. It's not withdrawing labour or shutting our doors. It's action that is legally permissible to stop more GP practice closures.
But it came, didn't it? This is what Wes Streeting was referring to. It came as new funding was announced at the beginning of August.
Well, our action has been well over a year in planning and has been growing in over even longer than that.
Yeah, but so then there was a new government and they made this decision.
The funding that was provided by the new government is still hundreds of millions less than we were in 2018. Back in 2008, the NHS pie that went into general practice was over 11%, and it shrunk by over half. So the amount of funding that we get a day per patient amounts to about 30 pence, less than the cost of an apple. And this is why we're seeing practices closing, because they're financially unviable. And the funding that went in, although very welcome, is still woefully inadequate to bring us back to what the government have promised. So a lot of what we have suggested aligns beautifully with the government's pre-election manifesto commitments, and I think could be a good news story.
Okay, so given what you're saying then, you don't like the term saber-rattling, but you are threatening a strike, aren't you? You're in work to rule at the moment, which is a form of industrial action, and you are threatening to strike if you don't get more money.
So let's be really clear about this. Saber-rattling and the comments that Mr. Streeting made yesterday would suggest that we are not in step with the rest of the profession. He didn't disclose that our mandate that we received in August was 98.3% of the GP contractor members. Now, where we are at the moment with closing practices and hemorrhaging GPs means the legally permissible actions that practices are taking are not designed to be harming patient care. They're designing to be keeping practices safe and keeping patients safe. So this actually is to protect your local GP service, to keep it open.
But it could go further. I just want to be clear about what you're saying. It could go further.
So if the government don't listen to us, and going by Dars's report yesterday, it actually, which comes out with so many themes that we have been saying and petitioning to government and NHS England over the past year, then if we don't see rapid action quickly enough, my worry is that the employed GPs or other employed members of staff, such as practice nurses, may decide to undertake a ballot to undertake industrial action and potentially even strike.
I want to play to you the other criticism that we heard yesterday, and this came from within the profession. This came from Sir John Bell, who's a doctor himself, and he was talking in particular, he was using this example to talk about attitudes to innovation. He said that there was a new drug lowering cholesterol involving injections rather than taking statins, and it was being offered to the NHS at what he described as a bargain basement price.
The NHS got very excited and said, we're going to roll out doses of this to 700,000 people in the first year. And it got to the GPs and they said, sorry guys, we're not going to do this.
Why?
Well, they're not getting paid enough for the injection that they were going to give. And they blocked it absolutely in its tracks.
How do you explain that?
So Professor Sir John Bell is on record as saying that general practice needs to be razed to the ground and we need to start again. This is a man with a real anti-GP agenda. The drug he's referring to is called inclisiran. Now, normally when a new drug comes on the market, it's always labelled with a black triangle. So when we prescribe, we know that there's a bit of an unknown safety profile. It's one thing having a research trial with thousands of patients. It's quite another rolling something out to our population across England, where we've got 63.9 million patients. This is also a drug that requires regular injections and regular blood tests. You're looking at perhaps potentially, you know, 8 to 10 appointments a year. Now, at the moment, we are delivering 367 million appointments a year, over 1.5 million appointments a day. All of those cost money, and there was zero resource behind this. But normally, if there's a really good drug, then GPs will prescribe it. But there's a real unknown safety profile with this drug that Dr. Bell is alluding to. And the NHS got it at a bargain basement price. That's not a reason for us to start injecting our patients with a brand new drug. GPs are medical doctors, and in all parts of professional life in clinical medicine, we do tend to be a little bit careful because we've had many new drugs rolled out across the past decade that have then later been withdrawn when the side effect profile becomes properly understood at a population level. So actually, what he was inferring and implying yesterday was wholly inappropriate to say to your listeners. That was really quite irresponsible comments on his behalf.
Dr. Katie Bramall-Stainer from the BMA GPs Committee, thanks.
18 minutes to 8 is the time. Ever since the Kremlin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, there's been widespread reporting of Russians themselves reporting fellow citizens to the police for anti-war views, often leading to prosecution and in some cases to prison sentences. It's revived memories of the Soviet past when informing on colleagues and neighbours was, of course, actively encouraged. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been meeting some of those caught up in this new wave of denunciations.
Handcuffed, a doctor is led into a Moscow courtroom and locked in a cage. Her name is Nadezhda Buyanova. She's 68. She's a paediatrician, and she's on trial for spreading false information about the Russian army. She faces up to 10 years in prison. I managed to ask Nadezhda what she makes of this. I read about this kind of thing happening to others, Nadezhda replies through the glass. I never imagined it would happen to me. It's happening because of this woman, a patient's mother. She claims that the doctor told her Russian soldiers in Ukraine are legitimate targets. She was furious. Her ex-husband had been killed fighting in Ukraine. She denounced Nadezhda to the police. That word, danos, denunciation, you hear it often now in Russia. Oleg Orlov experienced it firsthand. The human rights activist was denounced over an anti-war article he'd written. He was jailed for 2.5 years, but freed early in a prisoner swap. He's no longer in Russia. The machine of repression is working like in Joseph Stalin's time, Oleg tells me in a video call. There's no rationality to it. Now it's repression for the sake of repression. One of Stalin's ministers praises a boy who has denounced his own father as an enemy of the people. Denunciation was actively encouraged under Stalin. The Gulag was full of victims who'd been snitched on by fellow citizens. Nina Khrushcheva is professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She can see that today, Russians are having no problem turning the clock back.
What I find really remarkable is how quickly Russian genetic memory has come back. How people who didn't live in those times suddenly act as if they did. Suddenly they are squealing on others. It is a Soviet practice, but it's also something about the Russian genetic code of fear, of trying to protect themselves at the expense of others.
And it is Russia's war in Ukraine which is fueling this. Not only through repressive new laws aimed at silencing dissent, but by turbocharging here the hunt for internal enemies, for traitors. It's in this atmosphere of us against them that you get students informing on teachers, professors on students, parishioners on priests. And 400 miles north of Moscow, neighbour on neighbour. Hairdresser Anna Alexandrova had fallen out with her neighbour, Irina, over a plot of land in their village. Their feud led to Anna being reported to the police for posting anti-war messages. She denies sending them, but she's on trial now for spreading fake news about the army, and she faces up to 15 years in prison. This began as an ordinary domestic squabble, Anna's defence lawyer Anastasia Pilipenko tells me. But the so-called political articles of the criminal code have become a useful way of resolving problems between neighbours. Some Russians aren't just writing denunciations, they're taking the law into their own hands. On a Moscow bus, 87-year-old Dmitry Grinchy is attacked by two men who claim they've just heard him make insulting comments about Russian mercenaries fighting in Ukraine. Shocking mobile phone video shows the pensioner having his arms twisted behind his back, then being dragged off the bus and frog-marched to the police. He wasn't charged, but the incident has left the pensioner shaken and angry. The Russian constitution says that everyone has the right to free speech, Dmitry tells me. Why should others get to say what they think and not me? In his flat, Dmitry shows me old photos of his father, Pavel, who in 1937 was arrested and then executed, one of the many innocent victims of Stalin's terror. History never repeats itself exactly. But what is happening today is reviving ghosts of the past, with Russia once again searching for enemies and traitors, and Russians being encouraged to join the hunt.
Steve Rosenberg reporting. And now to Thought for the Day, which is with Jasveer Singh this morning from the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. If you're superstitious, you don't need me to tell you the bad news. Today is Friday the 13th. Triskaidekaphobia is a fear of the number 13. But whilst it's considered unlucky by some, for Sikhs, it's a number which literally makes us think of the Almighty. Before Guru Nanak set off on his travels across the length and breadth of Asia to share his message with humanity, he worked as a humble storekeeper for the state granary in a small town in Punjab. Farmers would come to the granary to pay their taxes with the crops they'd grown, and those crops would then be sold on. One day, Guru Nanak was selling grains to some customers. He weighed out the portions on the scales, counted them out, and when he came to the number 13, he paused for a moment. He then started to repeat the number 13 over and over again, still counting out the portions. The customers were elated, getting more free grain than they knew what to do with, whilst onlookers were amazed by the sheer recklessness of Guru Nanak's behaviour. When the state governor of the town became aware of the incident, the Guru was arrested and a stocktake of the granary was ordered. The Guru was questioned about what had happened. He said that in Punjabi, the number 13 sounds the same as the word for yours, and that he had been contemplating this similarity by repeating the word over and over again in meditation, that everything is yours, as in everything belongs to you, the Supreme Being. The stocktake was completed, and miraculously, the granary somehow showed a surplus rather than a loss. The Guru was released without charge. I visited the Gurdwara built on the site of the store where the Guru worked centuries ago. The weighing stones he used on that fateful day have been preserved and are kept on display there. The fact that one of the central teachings of the Sikh faith, that everything belongs to the Almighty, was crystallised in the Guru's mind from this mundane incident in everyday life, never ceases to amaze me. For Sikhs, the number 13 also reminds us of the temporary nature of human existence. We are here, now, but we won't be around forever. What we may own today is meaningless once we pass. As the old saying goes, we can't take it with us. But what we do with our resources in the present day can have a lasting legacy. If what we have ultimately belongs to the divine, then I believe that those of us who can should share our surplus resources as widely as we can, so that we can all flourish collectively and see the benefits spread across society like ripples in a pond, or, in Guru Nanak's case, like a never-ending supply of grain from a granary.
Jasveer Singh with Thought for the Day at 8:09.
From the sharing of sexual images to freedom of speech and its abuse to the harm done to children by algorithms that show them material that does them psychological harm, we're all of us trying to cope with social media use and its impact Over the summer, in the wake of the riots, the Mayor of London made his view clear. There need to be amendments to the Online Safety Act, he said. I think what the government should do very quickly is check if it's fit for purpose. I think it's not fit for purpose. So, what is the government's view? I've been talking to Peter Kyle, the Science, Innovation and Technology Secretary. So, first, is Sadiq Khan right?
The review of the Online Safety Act is underway. The trouble with the landscape that we inherited was that we had an Online Safety Act that took a long time to get through, almost 5 years for development and get through Parliament. And then the measures that flowed from it aren't going to come into force until 2026. So not all of it has been consulted on, implemented on, laid before Parliament before we can actually get the powers right that we need. So that's the challenge that we have.
So you would accept Sadiq Khan's point that at the moment it is not fit for purpose?
The bill is not fully implemented. And that's the challenge that we have. So when you say fit for purpose, we don't even have all the powers from the Act yet.
But I think what he was suggesting is you will need further powers.
What we are doing is just constantly reviewing the powers that we have. Now, the online world is moving very, very fast. The innovations that are coming out of these companies are moving extremely fast. Therefore, we need to keep on our toes. Now, it's very hard to accept the principle we might have to start legislating before the powers of the previous Act have come into force. Mm. That's the big fundamental challenge that I have inherited, because if you look at some of the issues about legal but harmful, for example, that was a big part of the bill going through Parliament. It got caught up in the infighting of the Tory party. Kemi Badenoch said that it was legalising or using the law to tackle hurt feelings, and the whole bit of the bill fell. So I've inherited a landscape that's quite lopsided. Not all of the measures have been implemented yet, and therefore I have to make sure I am able to use the powers right I do have in a way that makes a difference, which is what I'm trying to do at the moment with intimate image abuse. And then I will assess going forward what powers need to be enforced and what additional powers we might need going into the future.
And when it comes to children, are you tempted at all by what Australia is about to do, which seems to be to ban social media use in those either under 16 or under 14? They haven't settled on the age yet.
I'm really interested in the measures that Prime Minister Albanese is looking at. We don't know what the nature of the pilot is yet, and I'm going to be looking very closely. You know, there is considerable evidence that social media is harming vulnerable young people. It's making some young people increasingly vulnerable. We don't have yet much evidence about what action makes a big difference in response or is indeed effective. So I'm looking very closely at the Australian experience, and I'm open-minded. Of course, I'm going to keep everything on the table going forward, because I would do anything to keep young people safe. But it has to be measures that are enforceable and actually make the impact that we're driving towards.
Yeah, and when it comes to measures that are enforceable, what some people say, there was a BBC Panorama on this earlier in the month, on the way in which someone, I think it was a 16-year-old, is recommended images that are increasingly unpleasant and that he, in this case, didn't want to see. And that, of course, is not the simple fact of it being available on social media. It's the algorithms and your power as a government, I suppose our power as a society, to say to the social media companies, you must stop pushing this stuff.
And that's precisely what I'm doing today with intimate image abuse. One in seven women are experience the threat of intimate image abuse, or what's, you know, commonly called revenge porn. Today, what I'm doing is using those powers that I do have to insist that social media companies use algorithms from the outset in order, and they have to prove they're using their products to avoid this content making it online. When it does make it online, by law, they have to take action very, very swiftly. And then also taking the intent function away from the law when it comes to those people who do upload. So no longer have to prove intent. Any uploading of this sort of material is going to be a criminal offence. What this does is it starts pushing the onus onto tech companies to make sure they prove their products are safe before they are released into the society.
But they're not at the moment, are they?
I mean,
the fact is that the algorithms push things to people, and the algorithms are doing it in a way that doesn't take regard of people's safety, particularly children.
To date, when it comes to intimate image abuse, no. After this, they will.
But more widely as well.
Yeah. Well, I think what you can see from what I'm trying to do is move the onus away from reaction once these products are released in society, and then we understand the harms, to making sure there is an onus on the tech companies to ensure safety is baked in from the outset before they're released into the public. And increasingly, that's the approach that I'm going to be taking, because we've landed into a situation where tech companies are, or social media companies are allowed to release into society models which they haven't proven is safe before release, and then we then deal with the harms afterwards. I am moving to a system and making sure we can over time get to a place where products are proven safe before they are released into society. Now the fines that could be levied on tech companies are huge. You know, we're going for 10% of global earnings if they don't take the measures that we are insisting on today to keep women safe, mostly women safe, from intimate image abuse and the resulting impact.
Just a final thought about the power balance, though, that there is between you and them, because you can warn them, you can attack them, you can even fine them, but mostly they're not based here, are they?
That's why working internationally is incredibly important. And when you see the emerging power of AI, for example, the AI Safety Institute that was established by the previous administration, for which we are grateful for, we are investing into the future and making sure that safety when it comes to AI, again, is there at the beginning, so that AI is steered during the phase of it being developed and pre-release. We can only do that by working really effectively globally. So what we're doing is using our institute to work very closely with the US and the EU and other institutes around the world, so that we can work in tandem to ensure that powerful technologies as they're emerging are made safe from the outset. Now, we found these tech companies to be quite open to working with us in this case. We've been very, very fortunate in building strong relationships with our global partners, and this is a model that we need to use increasingly as we go forward, because we cannot act unilaterally in all of these situations. We're doing what we can domestically, but we're recognising that working globally has to be done in certain circumstances, and that's something that I've hit the ground running on.
Peter Carr, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. Thank you very much.
It is coming up to 8 o'clock. Stav has the weather.
Thanks very much, Michelle and Justin. Good morning to you. It is a cold start out there. One of the coldest mornings, in fact, this early in September for at least 5 years. We're down to -2 Celsius, even just below -2 Celsius at Topcliff and Eskdale Muir. And a number of stations are at around freezing. So a touch of frost this morning. We've got high pressure overhead, so light winds. That'll also allow for some mist and fog patches as well over the next few hours, which should tend to lift and clear. And then many of us will see a good deal of sunshine this morning. Into the afternoon, as the temperatures rise, we'll start to see a bit of fair weather cloud bubbling up. Could just give rise to the odd light shower, mainly across some central and eastern parts of the UK. And we'll still have a few showers peppering some coastal areas, but most places will be dry. Northern Ireland, though, will be turning cloudier through the afternoon with southwesterly winds picking up here. But elsewhere, it should stay dry with some sunshine. Top temperatures today, a little bit higher than yesterday. We're looking at 11 to 14 degrees across Scotland, Northern Ireland, 13 to 17 Celsius. For England and Wales. That's your forecast.
Stav, thank you. It's Friday. It's Any Questions Day. It's Alex Forsyth Day, that means. Where is she? She's on the line now. Morning, Alex.
Hello. Good morning, Justin. Next week marks 10 years since the Scottish independence referendum, and so tonight we're heading to Glasgow. On our panel, we have the leader of Scottish Labour, Anas Sarwar, the leader of the ALBA Party and former First Minister, Alex Salmond, the SNP's Public Finance Minister, Ivan McKee, and the Conservative peer and former leader of the Scottish Conservatives, Baroness Annabel Goldie. We've still got a few tickets left, so if you want to be in the audience, go to the BBC Any Questions website, where you can find all the details, and if not, you can listen live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4.
Alex, thank you very much. And before nine, we will be hearing from Poland's foreign minister and also from a former UK national security advisor on Ukraine, weapons and Russia.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussein and Justin Webb. It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 13th of September. The headlines this morning: Vladimir Putin's warning of a wider war if Ukraine strikes Russia with long-range missiles will be on the agenda when Keir Starmer meets President Biden. Members of a citizens' jury have said that terminally ill adults in England should be allowed to end their life if they wish. And the Competition and Markets Authority has warned that a proposed £15 billion merger between Vodafone and Three could lead to millions of customers paying more. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has arrived in Washington for talks with President Biden after Vladimir Putin issued his starkest warning yet about the dangers of loosening restrictions on the use of weapons supplied by the West. The Russian leader said that Europe and the United States would be in direct conflict with Moscow if they allowed Kyiv to attack Russian territory with long-range Western missiles. In response, Sir Keir stressed Ukraine's right to self-defence. Our political editor, Chris Mason, who's been travelling with the Prime Minister, sent this report from Washington.
This is Keir Starmer's second visit to the White House in 2 months. Ukraine's allies still remain rather guarded in their public remarks about a change in policy on the use of Western missiles inside Russia. But the diplomatic dashing to arrive at a decision is in plain sight. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Foreign Secretary David Lammy in Kyiv this week, Mr. Lammy telling The Telegraph it was vital to understand how we can put Ukrainians in a position to win and what is needed. The Prime Minister's in Washington today, the annual UN General Assembly's in New York the week after next. There are really important developments likely in the next few weeks and months, and therefore a number of tactical decisions ought to be taken, the Prime Minister told us. He was more direct in his response to Vladimir Putin's threats. Russia started this, he said. Moscow caused the conflict, and it could stop it.
This morning, Russian media has reported that the State Security Service has revoked the accreditation of 6 British diplomats, accusing them of spying. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner has this assessment of how Moscow could react if Western countries give Ukraine permission to use long-range weapons to attack Russian soil.
Is Vladimir Putin bluffing? That's the calculation that strategic planners and elected leaders in Washington and other Western capitals now have to make. Those in favour of allowing Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia argued that so far in this war, none of his so-called red lines have amounted to anything. The Russian leader hinted at retaliation if the West supplied Ukraine with main battle tanks, with long-range artillery, and then with F-16 warplanes. Each time, nothing happened. Mr. Putin already believes his country to be at war with NATO in all but name, so some argue, what difference would this make? But if Russia did retaliate this time, then it has a broad spectrum of options short of declaring war. At the milder end of the spectrum, it could launch so-called sub-threshold attacks, such as cyber attacks, interfering with undersea cables, or sending drones to disrupt Western air traffic. Other, far more dangerous but less likely options would include detonating a tactical nuclear warhead against Ukraine, or attacking a Western supply base inside a NATO country like Poland. And those scenarios are exactly what Washington is desperate to avoid.
The first citizens' jury on assisted dying in England has said the law should be changed to allow terminally ill adults to have help to end their lives. The research group, the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, commissioned the study to explore public views. It chose jury members to be representative of the population, which meant most were already in favour of assisted dying. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
The 30-member jury, of whom 28 voted, spent 8 weeks hearing evidence from experts and campaigners. Jurors voted by 3-1 in favour of assisted dying being available to those with a terminal condition who have the capacity to make their own decisions. Key motivations for supporting a change in the law were to stop pain and knowing that you could die with dignity. Those against were worried it could be misused without adequate safeguards. There was near universal support for more funding for palliative care. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has promised to give MPs a free vote on assisted dying at some point, with private members' bills already introduced at Westminster and at the Scottish Parliament, Holyrood.
The Competition and Markets Authority has warned that a proposed merger between the telecoms companies Vodafone and Three could lead to their 27 million customers paying more, as well as result in a reduced service. The CMA said it was particularly concerned that price hikes would affect people least able to afford a mobile phone. The two firms say the £15 billion deal will lead to greater investment. But Stuart McIntosh from the CMA told us it isn't convinced of the benefits.
Vodafone and Three say that the merger will actually increase competition because of the investments they would make in their network, particularly in their new 5G infrastructure. But we're not convinced that the merged company will actually follow through fully with the investments they're talking about, or that the benefits of the merger would be as great as they claim. So today we're setting out our findings and analysis, and we're also consulting on potential solutions like legally binding investment commitments.
More than 30,000 workers at the aerospace giant Boeing are to go on strike after overwhelmingly rejecting a new pay offer, which was backed by their own union. The industrial action will affect Boeing's major production sites in Washington and Oregon. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
This is a severe blow to Boeing and an embarrassment for its new chief executive, Kelly Ortberg. The company had described the new contract offer, which would have provided a pay increase of 25% over 4 years, as historic. The emphatic rejection, with 96% of those polled voting for strike action, has exposed a deep rift between Boeing's management and a powerful section of its workforce. This comes at a time when the aerospace giant is already wrestling with a serious safety and quality control crisis. The strike will affect some of the company's most important facilities, including factories where the 737 MAX and the 777 are built. Analysts say an extended shutdown could cost the company and its suppliers billions of dollars.
The Prime Minister says there's been no formal assessment of how the health and well-being of pensioners will be affected by the decision to cut winter fuel support in England and Wales. The Conservatives had called for any such reports to be published. Here's our political correspondent, Leila Nathu.
At Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, the Conservative leader Rishi Sunak attacked Sir Keir Starmer's decision to means test the winter fuel payment and repeatedly pressed him to publish an impact assessment of the policy change. The Prime Minister ducked the question, but speaking to reporters travelling with him to Washington last night, Sir Keir said there was no such analysis. Downing Street insisted the government wasn't required to produce a formal document to assess the impact on people affected by the cut and said they would ensure the most vulnerable pensioners would receive support.
Reports say Israeli commandos have carried out a rare attack in Syria, infiltrating and blowing up a military site on Sunday. Israel has not commented on the claims in some newspapers, including the New York Times, that an underground missile factory built with Iranian help was destroyed during the raid. The government has confirmed that a ban on junk food adverts being shown on television before 9 in the evening will come into force from October next year. Ministers say it's part of a campaign to crack down on child obesity and reduce pressure on the health service. The broadcaster and chef, Hugh Fernley-Whittingstall, told this programme that more needed to be done.
We can't really have a coherent conversation about the future of the NHS unless tackling obesity is at the heart of it, because it's the single biggest cause of preventable illness, of early death, and it's the single biggest expense of any disease, and living with obesity is a disease, for the NHS. So this is just one step among many that need to be taken, but it's extremely welcome.
Two men have been charged with burglary after a painting by Banksy was stolen from a gallery in London on Sunday. They are Larry Fraser, who's 47, and James Love, who's 53. Police say the artwork, called Girl with Balloon, has been recovered and will be returned to the gallery. The Duke of Sussex has told the BBC he was anxious about turning 30, but is excited about turning 40 this weekend. He'll spend his birthday on Sunday privately with family in California, before heading off on a weekend away with close friends. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
His 30s have been a turbulent decade for the Duke of Sussex. He's become a husband and a father, split acrimoniously from the royal family, stopped being a working royal and moved to California. But he appears to be approaching his 40th with a sense of positivity. In a statement, Prince Harry told the BBC he was anxious at 30, but is excited about 40, with a mission to continue doing good. He spoke about his children, Archie and Lilibet, saying that becoming a father had given him a fresh perspective, describing it as one of life's greatest joys that have made him more committed to making the world a better place. The statement ended on an optimistic note from Prince Harry. Bring on the next decade, he said.
Daniela Ralph reporting.
Jane, thank you very much. The time is 8:10. Six British diplomats in Moscow learned this morning they were no longer diplomats as far as Russia is concerned. Their accreditation is being revoked, Russian media began reporting. It's a decision that would appear to be connected to the White House talks later today between Keir Starmer and Joe Biden, where it seems the two countries and other allies of Ukraine are moving closer to allowing it to use their weapons to strike targets deep inside Russia. President Putin has said that would mean war between Russia and NATO. I've been speaking to Radek Sikorski, Poland's foreign minister, and I asked first what he thought of Mr. Putin's latest words.
I was actually yesterday in the Ukrainian city of Lviv on my way to Kiev, where a Russian long-range missile hit a residential area. 180 different places in Lviv were destroyed or damaged. And I visited a place where the father of the family saw the bodies of his wife and three daughters being carried out, and he's himself in a terrible state. And as you know, Russia has been sending long-range missiles into Ukraine for months, since the beginning of this war, hitting the Ukrainian power generation system, heating systems, destroying 70% of Ukraine's electricity generating capacity with the winter coming. These are war crimes, and these missiles are launched from bombers from inside Russian territory that start from airfields on Russian territory. And to prevent these launches seems to me completely justified in international law for Ukraine to do.
So you think the US and the UK should not even hesitate then in going ahead with a formal decision to allow Ukraine to use the arms it supplied to hit targets deep in Russia?
Well, I'm surprised that there were these restrictions before, because when you supply weapons, you usually allow the victim of aggression to use all force necessary to counter the act of aggression. And it's very difficult what to make of President Putin's words, because he is such a liar. He lied that it wasn't his forces that did the Anschluss of Crimea. He lied that he had absolutely no intentions of invading Ukraine. And then he drew these red lines at every stage of our assistance to Ukraine. The supply of tanks, the supply of aircraft, these nuclear threats. He's lost credibility, and therefore we don't know whether he means it.
But he has been quite specific now in the way that he is characterising what a decision for the use of these long-range systems will actually mean. He says Ukraine essentially can't do this alone, that targets in Russia could only be struck with intelligence data from satellites that Ukraine doesn't have, that those satellites belong to the EU, the USA and NATO countries. Essentially, he says only servicemen of NATO countries can input flight missions into these missile systems, which is why he's essentially now characterizing this as a direct war with Russia.
I can't tell you, because I don't know what the technicalities are, but I'm sure the Russian army uses the GPS system, which is owned by the West too. So I'm not sure that's a decisive argument. The victim of aggression has the right to defend itself, including on the territory of the aggressor. That's international law.
Do not worry about what that could mean for Poland, the war moving into a new phase or a new dimension. You are a frontline state. I know you already have Russian drones, at the very least, over Polish territory from time to time.
You keep asking us what we think about Putin's red lines, but you never ask us what our red lines are. And our red lines are that these Russian drones and missiles should not be flying into our airspace, risking the lives and the property of our citizens. And somehow President Putin doesn't seem to be worried about that. He has no business sending aircraft and drones over Ukraine, which is a member of the UN in good standing, which is attacked in a blatant colonial war of aggression. Yes, there are always risks, but I don't think Russia will dare to start a war with NATO, because Russia is finding it impossible to defeat Ukraine, let alone NATO.
You think President Putin's bluffing?
He could end this war in 5 minutes by making a phone call, and he should.
That's Radek Sikorski, who is the Foreign Minister of Poland. And in the studio here is Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, former head of the Foreign Office, former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, and also a former National Security Advisor. Good morning, Lord Ricketts.
Good morning, Michelle.
Let us begin with the news that we had this morning, when Russian media began reporting that six British diplomats in Moscow are having their diplomatic accreditation revoked. Any doubt in your mind that this is connected to what we've been discussing and to the meeting Keir Starmer's having today?
Absolutely no doubt. The timing is too coincidental. This is Russian punishment for the UK being seen as a cheerleader for supplying weapons to Ukraine. I mean, the reasons they give in their statement are completely trumped up. And we're told that the Russian spy agency has documents from a department in the Foreign Office which say that the task of the embassy is ensuring Russia's strategic defeat against Ukraine. Well, surprise, surprise. I mean, that's been British declared policy for 2.5 years. So, yeah, this is a trumped up story to create pressure on the British government.
And will it affect the capability of the embassy, the fact it's 6 diplomats?
Well, I think it will. I mean, that's quite a large number. I don't know who they are, but it's not an enormous embassy. And it's in everyone's interest that the two sides should have embassies who can report accurately what the government and public opinion are saying. So, yeah, this will, for a time, diminish what the embassy can do.
And on this central question, where a decision appears to be coming on Ukraine's use of long-range missiles, what is your view? Is there a danger that this provokes Russia?
Well, first of all, I think there's absolutely no surprise that Putin has taken the opportunity to get his strike in first rhetorically. The agonising in Washington has been going on for months about this very publicly. Of course, Putin is going to try and intimidate Western politicians and publics from taking this step. I mean, my own feeling is, of course, there's a risk. You have to judge that risk. But you have to weigh it against the risk of not acting. And I think that's the greater risk, that we are too cautious in how Ukraine can use the weapons we've supplied. And in the end, Russia comes out on top of this war in whatever settlement is reached. So I think balancing those off, the right thing is to trust our Ukrainian ally to set parameters. Of course, they must use these weapons responsibly within international humanitarian law.
See, they could have said all of that right at the start. Perhaps that should be done at the point you supply the weapons, not after the fact.
Each stage along this process of equipping Ukraine, the West has been hesitant before deciding to go ahead on tanks, on the aircraft, on long-range artillery, now on this. I agree. I think if you supply Storm Shadow missiles, you should be ready to trust your Ukrainian ally to operate within international humanitarian law. I think it's Washington that's had the particular problems. It looks like there's some movement underway. We will see.
And so to the meeting then between Joe Biden and Keir Starmer today. It's going to be the second time Keir Starmer has seen him since he became Prime Minister. You've been in the room, I think, for meetings of this kind. What are they like?
I've been in with David Cameron to the Oval Office for these sort of meetings, yes. I mean, of course, it's a very exciting moment for any new Prime Minister to be in the Oval Office. There'll be only a small number of people. And although this is the headline issue, there will be other issues as well. I think we're now at an interesting stage. Joe Biden is no longer running for president. He's got 4 months to be president. And I think the key thing is to get Ukraine in as good shape as possible for whatever lies ahead, including possible Trump presidency. The economic side, we mustn't neglect, because if you remember, there was this $50 billion package of financial engineering that would turn the accrued profits on frozen assets into $50 billion euros. Dollars. That hasn't yet begun flowing, so there's economic support for Ukraine. And there's also Israel-Gaza, which I'm sure will be the other major issue on the agenda. So it's going to be a packed agenda, two and a half hours, I think, of discussion, and very important moment for the US-UK relationship.
The proper business gets done. I mean, decisions get taken on the spot rather than deferred to officials.
The big political decisions get taken there, yes. I mean, I think the issue about the missiles may not be announced today. The Americans may want to hold that back till next week, not look like it's been dragged out of the president by the British Prime Minister. But yeah, this is the moment where all the work at official level comes up to the leaders and they do take the big decisions, yeah.
Peter Ricketts, thank you very much. And also with us on the line is Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Jeremy Bowen, if this decision is announced or when it is announced, does Ukraine have a list of targets ready that it would use these missiles for?
Yeah, they've said this. And these missiles, you never know, it might help protect Ukrainian cities, its energy infrastructure. What they won't be able to do is to head off the current Russian campaign to capture Pokrovsk in the east, which is a strategic, very important railway junction. So the fact is that throughout the war, as Zelensky has pushed for better, stronger weapons, none of them have actually been a miracle in all of this. They have not given the Ukrainians the victory that they want. Far from it.
But the fact that this would come after they've done something really striking in recent weeks, haven't they, with the incursion into the Kursk region, perhaps in combination, this, could we be coming up to a moment that is more of a game changer?
You know, I doubt it. I don't think that these would change the way that the war is. Might change some of the details of what's going on and will give Ukraine certainly something else to hit the Russians with, but they won't win the war for Ukraine. Now, David Lammy, Britain's foreign secretary, told The Telegraph that the UK and its allies need to be in a position to put Ukraine, to give Ukraine a victory. But, you know, winning on the battlefield, if that's what he means, would require massive amounts of weapons and ammunition and troops that Ukraine just doesn't have. And it's interesting that Keir Starmer said that, of course, Ukraine has the right of self-defense. So staving off defeat and defending yourself is not the same as being able to either drive the Russians out or persuade Putin that the game is not worth the consequences for Russian. For Russia, you know, Putin's giving every objective that this is a very important strategic decision for him, that he doesn't want Ukraine to be a bastion of the West. And, I mean, my instinct is that the war will continue as long as he's in the Kremlin.
Jeremy Bowen, thank you very much. And thank you to Lord Ricketts as well.
21 minutes past eight. Donald Trump is not going to do another presidential debate. He's decided that he won the encounter with Kamala Harris on Tuesday. His opponents say he pulled out though because further discussions would be pointless because he lost and would lose again. And most observers, including many Republicans, think he did lose because Kamala Harris made him angry and he didn't put her on the spot for her changes in attitude to many of America's problems. David Frum, the former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, now staff writer at The Atlantic, has been telling me that Donald Trump's reaction in the aftermath of the debate was, in his view, predictable.
The way narcissistic personalities deal with defeats is by denying that they ever happened at all and by denying that the person who inflicted the defeat exists in the first place. That's why as Donald Trump was getting his beating at the hands of Vice President Harris, he wouldn't look at her, wouldn't say her name. She was just a collection of pronouns, she, her, you. And it's not surprising that after he absorbed the magnitude of the defeat, he's responded by saying, A, I won, and B, I'm never going to do that again.
Because we've done two debates and because they were successful, there will be no third debate. It's too late anyway. The voting's already begun. You got to go out and vote.
Two nights ago, Donald Trump and I had our first debate. And I believe we owe it to the voters to have another debate. Because this election and what is at stake could not be more important.
Do you think it is him who has made that decision, though, or his minders who want to avoid a similar defeat another time round? In other words, is he still in control of his campaign?
We need the universe to make sense. That's why people believe in astrology. No one wants to think that the nominee of the Republican Party, the past president of the United States, is a person utterly in the grip of irrational impulses, not fully sane, and not able to make good decisions. They want to believe that there must be some puppet master behind this who knows what he's doing. But yes, it's Trump, and he's making bad decisions for bad reasons.
Interesting that Dick Cheney, and you used to work in the Bush administration, that Dick Cheney, his vice president, has come out and said that he is now going to vote for Kamala Harris. Is there a reason why George W. Bush doesn't do the same thing? And would you expect other senior Republicans now to join that bandwagon, if indeed it is a bandwagon?
Well, many senior Republicans have joined with former Vice President Cheney. I think Mitt Romney has made it pretty clear how he would vote. It's a heavy thing for George W. Bush, who has been so outside politics, to reenter it. It needs to be understood what Cheney is talking about. I'm sure Cheney and Harris agree about very, very little. And not just Harris. I mean, Harris now heads a coalition that spans all the way from Bernie Sanders to Dick Cheney. They don't agree on much. What we agree on is how we should make decisions. So you think taxes should be down here. This guy thinks taxes should be up here. You think healthcare policy should look like this. He thinks it should look like that. But what we can agree on is how we'll decide. And what we can agree on is if we've counted the noses and my side wins or your side wins, well, then we have to accept that.
Meanwhile, if this is going to be the only debate, how much impact do you think it's had?
We have just seen a president of the United States driven from office. by a debate, by a defeat in a debate. So I don't want to hear anyone say that debates don't matter. If debates don't matter, Joe Biden would be the incumbent president of the United States on his way to a second term. Debates matter. But they don't matter instantly, always. We're told that about 61 million Americans viewed this debate, either on TV or through some kind of streaming service. The electorate in 2024 will likely be at least double that, maybe even bigger. So many of the double the 61 million who watched it are going to absorb bits and pieces of the debate via TikTok or YouTube or other platforms over coming days. So this is not a once and for all event. It's a slowly seeping awareness that Donald Trump was bested by a woman he called dumb as a rock. Karl Rove, who was President Bush's campaign advisor, said, Trump called Kamala Harris dumb as a rock. Trump lost to her. So what does that make him?
Yeah. Does that, though, have a kind of drip-drip effect that can't be overcome by other events that might happen between now and Election Day, do you think? Is it that significant?
Well, what other events do you have in mind? I mean, if there's an invasion of Martians who all proclaim that Donald Trump should be the ruler of the universe, that could help.
Well, entirely possible given recent events, one might think.
Given the probable events, every event that has happened has been one that reminds Americans how unfit for duty Donald Trump is and has reconciled Americans to a vice president about whom they don't know very much, who would be the first female president, a person of color, many strikes against her in American society. She certainly exercised personal dominance over that bully Donald Trump in their one face-to-face encounter.
David Frum, thank you. And it's 27 minutes past eight, and it's time for the sport. And here's Carthy.
Morning, Justin. Thank you. A hearing to examine 115 Premier League charges against Manchester City will now begin on Monday. City were referred to an independent commission by the Premier League in February of 2023 over allegedly breaking the financial rules of the competition. The BBC Sports editor Dan Rowan outlines the charges.
These charges are spread over 14 seasons. They stand accused of subverting profit and sustainability rules, which limit losses by failing to provide, in effect, accurate financial information. Now, City, it's important to stress, have always strongly denied the charges. And while the speculation is intensifying, of course, no one truly knows what the outcome will be.
Golf's Solheim Cup starts today in Virginia, with the holders Europe needing 14 points to retain the trophy for a record fourth time, while the USA need 14.5 points to win. There's commentary of day one of the Solheim Cup from 5 o'clock on the BBC Sport website and app, and on 5 Live from 8.30. While Rory McIlroy is just two shots off the lead of England's Tom Clements after day one of the Irish Open at Royal County Down. Now, it is the second men's T20 between England and Australia tonight at 6.30 in Cardiff. A relatively inexperienced England side beaten by 28 runs in the first T20. Ebony Rainford-Brent is part of the Test Match special team and joins us now. Ebony, morning. A defeat
morning.
First, but what can England build on from that?
Yeah, look, it was a defeat, but it is a new-look sort of changing of the guard. We've seen the retirement of players like Moeen Ali, no Chris Jordan in the side, but young players coming through, which is exciting. Jacob Bethel, who's just 20 years of old, is one to talk about. And I think the frustrating thing, obviously, is the loss. There was a lot of shots where I think they would feel like they were a little bit loose and maybe going at it too hard. But I think that's to be expected. They want to keep up that exciting, aggressive brand. So for me, I think in this second T20, it's going to be saying, look, build on the skill set that they have, being aggressive, but just give themselves a little chance and they might take on Australia better.
Yeah, and one of the other factors was that England did tend to get some of their control back by bowling, I think it was 10 straight overs of spin. Did those bowlers impress you?
Yeah, really impressive, actually. I think, first of all, Liam Livingstone was outstanding. He nearly had a hat-trick. And he's the oldest in the side now. He's 31, and it makes you think he's the oldest when you've got sort of 20-year-olds in there. But he really led that charge really well. Adil Rashid as well provided that beautiful control. But it was really nice to see Josh Bethel, the youngster, left-arm spinner, add to that. So as a unit, they bowled those 10 overs, really actually dragged the game back. It looked like Australia were going to fly. So that is something that Phil Salt, who's captain at the moment while Joss Butler's ill, will be thinking. Spinners look good. They've really provided control and lots of variety. So excellent to see.
And just briefly, Australia, dangerous as always, but I presume this is the kind of test that England need this summer, isn't it?
Yeah, really dangerous. I think it's the first time I've seen England look bullied, actually. Travis Head went absolutely, he went all over the place, hitting the ball out the park. So they're going to have to just think about containing him. So Australia are going to be a real threat tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Ebony Brain from Brent and the Test Match Special Team will be on Five Sports Extra from 6:15. Thanks, Ebony. A few other headlines for you. Great Britain's Davis Cup tennis team face Argentina today in Manchester. They had a tight 2-1 win in their opening tie against Finland. And there's commentary of first practice at Formula One's Azerbaijan Grand Prix on Five Sports Extra from 10:30 this morning. The racing tips return, as they do for big meetings on the calendar, which includes the St. Ledger Festival at Doncaster, 2:25, number 3, Jonquil, and 3 o'clock, Doncaster, number 1, Istead.
Cathy, thank you. The reunion will be here just after 9. Here's Kirsty Walk with the details.
The images of the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 are familiar to many of us. Ecstatic people surging from east to west through the checkpoints, driving in tiny Trabant cars to meet relatives in the west. Many of them came here to the Brandenburg Gate, previously off limits in no man's land, for a monumental party, rejecting communism and embracing freedom. But that narrative was by no means a universal one. We brought together six Berliners whose lives were changed forever after the events of that night to give their own more nuanced perspectives. That's The Fall of the Berlin Wall in The Reunion this morning at 9 o'clock and on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, it's going to be bright and chilly, at least in the start, with quite a lot of sunshine, then cloudier through the afternoon, some rain moving across Northern Ireland and Scotland, largely dry elsewhere. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Justin Webb. It is 29 minutes to 9. Jane Steele has the news.
Keir Starmer has said Britain doesn't seek any conflict with Moscow in response to a warning from Vladimir Putin that Russia would be at war with the West if Ukraine was allowed to use long-range missiles to attack targets within Russia. The Prime Minister, who's visiting Washington, said Kiev had the right to defend itself. Poland's Foreign Minister, Radek Sikorski, told us Russia wouldn't dare to start a war with NATO because it was already finding it impossible to defeat Ukraine. It's been reported that Russia has revoked the accreditation of six British diplomats, accusing them of espionage. Russia's Interfax news agency said the State Security Service claimed the spies threatened the country's security. A panel of people chosen to reflect the population of England has called for assisted dying to be legalised for those who are terminally ill and capable of taking decisions. The citizens' jury was set up by the charity the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. The Competition and Markets Authority has warned that a proposed merger between the telecoms companies Vodafone and Three could lead to their 27 million customers paying more, as well as result in a reduced service. The CMA said it was particularly concerned that price hikes would affect people least able to afford a mobile phone.
Thank you, Jane. And let's pick up on that at 27 minutes to 9. We heard earlier this morning, didn't we, that the merger between those two very big mobile networks, Vodafone and Three Mobile, is in some trouble. The CMA hasn't made a final determination, but it's a preliminary finding that the deal would weaken competition between mobile networks and then, as we were hearing in the news, lead to higher prices. Let us talk to Ahmed Essam Shalbeya, who is the CEO for European Markets of Vodafone and is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Justin.
What's your reaction to what the CMA is saying?
Yeah, I think before I get to the reaction, I think it's really important to look at the heart of what we are proposing, which is a merger that is an $11 billion investment in digital infrastructure to build the UK's best mobile network. It delivers massive benefits to consumers in towns, in cities, in villages. This includes bringing 5G to every hospital, school and university across the UK. As you said, the CMA published today its provisional finding, and I have to say this, they are provisional, meaning we still have a lot of next steps to work through with the CMA to address the concerns that they might have. We're confident that we will be able to work positively with the CMA to reach a positive.
Oh, well, that's interesting. You are confident, aren't you? Because they want you to do various things or provide various assurances. You think you can?
I think we need to work closely with the CMA over the coming period. I think we've already made significant commitments as part of this process in terms of, and just to highlight maybe two of them, we've made a significant commitment of the $11 billion investment. We're willing to make sure that this is legally binding and we undertake a commitment to deploy this investment over the coming period. We've also made a big trade of radio waves with one of our competitors. I mean, at the heart of this deal, we believe this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to really take the UK back where it should belong in terms of 5G ranking across the world.
But and it would reduce competition, wouldn't it? I mean, there's no real doubt about that.
So We disagree on the position of pricing that comes from the CMA. We believe this adds to the competition in the market.
How
we
so?
Believe that, I mean, any consumer in the UK can easily recognize that if you go out there and you're buying from mobile, you have more than 100 brands to buy from. I think we're not taking out from this competition. We're adding a quality network that is scaled enough to provide the best competition.
Yeah, but the point, sorry to interrupt, but the point the regulator makes is that there is a risk that a smaller player, and they rent space from the bigger operators, that they might not be able to get such a good deal in the future. Are you saying that isn't the case?
No, we disagree on this conclusion because I believe that today more than 90% of these wholesale players, you're talking about the likes of Sky, Lebara, ID, all of the operators that operate on our networks, 90% of them are not on our network to start with. So we're more than interested and incentivized to work and operate and address their needs. And not only they will be getting better pricing, they will also be getting a quality network.
Are you also saying that those things you've started out by laying out the context from your perspective, the greater investment, et cetera, the connectivity that isn't at the moment very good and might get much better, are you saying none of that can happen if this doesn't go ahead?
From our perspective, it's... I think you only need to look into the facts today. And I'm sure you travel to other countries and you can see the difference in the level of service we have here in the UK versus other countries. Today, the UK lags behind many of our European peers, lags behind all of the G7 countries. And I think we have an opportunity to really bring back the UK to where it belongs from a digital infrastructure perspective. The merger is a vehicle to get this to happen. It's not every day that you get 11 billion of our own money going into investing in digital infrastructure. There are no taxpayer money that's needed to firefight or bridge the gap. There is a big problem when it comes to digital divide. You have many families, many businesses in rural areas, cities and towns where they don't really have access to what they deserve. And I think the merger really gets to the heart of this.
Ahmed SM Shelbaya, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is 23 minutes to nine. Climate and extreme poverty, that link was at the heart of a speech that David Miliband gave this week at the think tank Chatham House. The former foreign secretary is president of the International Rescue Committee aid organisation, and he is in one of our radio cars now. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
To what extent is that link much greater today than what you would have said 5 years ago?
Very significantly. I mean, what's happened is that 16 countries that are caught up in conflict, countries like Sudan, Somalia, those countries are in the top quartile of the most vulnerable climate countries in the world. And they now account for a staggering 43% of total number of people in extreme poverty and 79% of the people who depend on aid organizations like the International Rescue Committee. And that link is growing step by step. If I tell you that in the central Sahel region of Africa, the average rise in temperature is more than 50% greater than the global average, you'll immediately see that there's this coming together of two critical forces. There's the conflict multiplier that the climate crisis represents. There's more stress on resources, there's more likelihood of conflict. But secondly, the climate crisis is also an inequality multiplier because of the way in which it's destroying livelihoods. And so we're seeing this link between conflict and climate much more strongly in some of the most vulnerable parts of the world.
And that also must mean more disruption, more dislocation, more migration.
Yes, there's no question about it. I think it's important to say I'm leery of the debate about quote-unquote climate refugees, because the truth is that most people in Sudan or in Somalia who are moved, they move inside their own country. But you'll know that in the Sudan crisis, 20 million people in humanitarian need out of a population of 45 million, about 12 million internally displaced, and about 2 million have gone to neighboring states. So there is a cross-border effect, but most migration that's the result of the climate crisis is within countries. They're internally displaced. And we're seeing that around the world, and it's obviously adding massively to the total number of people who are displaced by conflict and disaster around the world, which is now about 120 million, so one in 70 of the global population.
Do you have a specific call that you are making in relation to the nexus of these two issues? Because combating climate change is a generational battle. We can already see how even the richest countries in the world are struggling with the costs of it. And what you are talking about are, you know, urgent matters of life and death today.
Yes, we have three calls. Call number one is to change the balance between fighting climate change and adapting to it. When I was Environment Secretary 15 years ago, 20 years ago, if you talked about adaptation, it was almost like you were giving up on mitigation. Well, we haven't done enough to mitigate climate change. We've got to do more, but we also have to get at least 50% of the international funding for climate going into adaptation in some of the poorest places. Second thing that is absolutely critical is that we have to make sure that these fragile states get their fair share of the total resources that are available. At the moment, only 15% of the British aid budget goes to fragile and conflict states. And thirdly, we have to change the way in which we deliver policy on the ground. At the moment, there's a simple model where the World Bank, which is a critical player in this, gives money to governments. The governments then have to work. In fragile and conflict states, there's got to be a completely different way of delivering, using civil society, using local NGOs, because at the moment, the money's not getting spent even when it's allocated.
Well, when you say adaptation, you mean things like, I imagine, help with different crops, help with shelter that withstands extreme temperatures and climate?
That's exactly right. I mean, in the conflict area of northeast Syria, my own organization, we're doing some amazing work with local farmers on seed strengthening, because conflict interferes with planting and harvesting. The climate crisis is interfering with the productivity. We're showing how you can adapt seeds. We're doing that in Pakistan as well, Niger. So that's a very good example where rural populations, they need much greater, stronger seeds to help them get through this. But obviously, it's a massive urban issue as well. There's going to be adaptation in urban areas. We're used to that in rich countries. I mean, the truth is that the poorer you are, the less help you get with climate adaptation. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Can we talk about Gaza? Because I know, obviously, it's one of the many issues that you are involved in and your organisation has worked in Gaza over the years. Obviously, today, Keir Starmer is going to be meeting President Biden. The US has been trying to get a ceasefire deal. It has not happened. It's not the first time the prospect of it seems to go further away, having seemed so immediate at one point. What is the way to get that ceasefire?
Well, the situation is on the ground, first of all, is absolutely hellish. And the desperate needs of the 2 million Palestinian civilians, the desperate need of the more than 100 hostages, they require two things. There's a twin track, I think, for Keir Starmer, for Joe Biden today. First of all, I mean, the ceasefire deal is there on the table. And maximum pressure on all sides is the desperate need, both for humanitarian reasons and for political reasons. Obviously, if I had a simple quick fix, it would have been done by someone else a long time ago. But it's about maximum pressure on all of the parties. The second thing, though, is it's impossible to overstate how grave the humanitarian situation is, independent of the ceasefire. I mean, the amount of food, the amount of water, the amount of medical supplies, the denial of entry of medical supplies on so-called dual-use grounds is compounding the misery that is created by the multiple movements of people, including our own staff, who are forced to shift. We've got our 11th emergency medical team working hospitals. That gets disrupted. We've got nutrition teams on the ground. We've got staff doing water and sanitation, 40,000 people a day, dependent on the IRC for their water supplies. But the ability of them to do their work is massively inhibited by the constraints on humanitarian aid going in and by the constraints on humanitarian movement inside the Gaza Strip.
David Miliband, President of the International Rescue Committee, thank you very much. Well, the 11 months of this war between Hamas and Israel has caused some people to avert their eyes from the news. But a film to be shown on ITV this Sunday illustrates how individual lives have been changed for forever. And it allows its subjects, both Israeli and Palestinian, to speak about their own pain and loss. From a young woman in Gaza who searches for even small body parts of her father after a strike so that she can bury those remains, to an Israeli teenager taken hostage, as well as others. The film is called Israel and Gaza Into the Abyss. It was filmed, directed and produced by Robin Barnwell, who's here in the studio now. Morning, Robin.
Good morning.
First of all, on the way that you filmed, because you couldn't film in Gaza, you made a decision not to ask your Palestinian contributors to go out and film especially for this. Why?
I think we didn't want to put them at additional risk. I mean, there's, you know, as you know, a shocking number of Palestinian journalists have been killed, camera people killed in Gaza filming the war. And we felt that we could find stories and characters who had been filming themselves already, and whose we could build their story with footage that had already existed. And so we took the decision that we didn't want to put anyone in, you know, excessive danger.
And you've ended up with three main Palestinian contributors and three main Israeli contributors. And on the Israeli contributors, there are sequences where they are describing what they went through on October the 7th, including one woman who saw her daughter murdered. And we can see the Hamas footage at the same time as they speak.
Yeah, so Hamas basically picked up Gali Adan's phone, this 50-year-old lady in Nachal Oz, and they, essentially what they went into her house, they actually shot dead her 18-year-old daughter in front of her eyes, and then they took her, Gali, and the mother's phone, and then started live-streaming everything that was going on inside the house. So you have this sort of extraordinary interaction between the Hamas fighters and Gali and her husband, who's now been taken hostage, where he was taken hostage on October 7th and is still in Gaza, fate unknown. Mm. And so you see this sort of dramatic footage. I mean, it was one of the, you know, we were trying to find really powerful scenes, essentially, to sort of try and convey the tragedy of both sides and the agonies of both sides, and to humanize the victims of October 7th and, of course, the tragic war in Gaza that followed. And basically, you know, Gali's footage was, and the phone, the live stream of Hamas was just so shocking. It was one of those images that, you know, will always remain with her, and watching her children, you know, sitting on the ground, fearing for their lives.
We actually have a little part of the account she gave you. Here it is.
I was very much in favour of a two-state solution and giving all the rights to the Palestinians in Gaza. On October the 7th, I found out that the hatred towards Israelis and Jews spans all generations. I don't think it's possible to live as two states when one of them wants to annihilate the other.
This gets to the very sad conclusions that you come to towards the end of your film. You worked on this for months, didn't you? What did you come away with overall at the end of all that time looking at this footage and working on it?
I mean, I've been going to the region for 30 years, and I've never seen Israelis and Palestinians so psychologically further from each other. And I think throughout the documentary, we wanted to show that Palestinians and Israelis, you know, how their views of each other have changed. And that's why we wanted to make a film with both sides and both victims from both sides in, because we wanted to actually show, if you want to understand the future of this conflict, I think you need to understand the trauma of what people have been through and the triggers of October the 7th that triggered a lot of Israelis and their memories of Holocaust. And again, the triggers of the war in Gaza for Palestinians, looking back at what they call the Nakba, when 700,000 of them fled or expelled from their homes.
And indeed, many of the Palestinians living in Gaza were people who left home, descendants of people
indeed,
who left homes in what is now Israel. Here's another clip, which is one of your Palestinian contributors, a man called Dr. Mohammed El-Ran, who was the head of surgery at Gaza's Indonesian hospital, and who was arrested and held by the Israeli army for a while, during which time he said he was tortured. But this is what he says towards the end of the film.
There was a period of time when there was coexistence between the two peoples, between Israelis and Palestinians. But in war, these aren't the Jews we know, nor the Israeli military or civilians we interacted with in the past.
It's such a striking similarity with what Gali Adan says, that things just aren't the same and perhaps can never be the same again. Not that the past was, you know, was anything which truly gave them peace and security.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the parallel between Gali and Dr. Mohammed El-Ran, their views have changed of each other. Gali was in a kibbutz, actually had very sort of liberal views, and actually those people living in the kibbutzim have actually, some of them experiencing October 7th have changed their views. But I want to highlight, actually, that there's also a Palestinian character, Ibrahim, and Batsheva from another kibbutz in Israel. And there are still people in Gaza and Israel who, you know, want us to find a solution to the conflict, and their views are unpopular at the moment. But, you know, there is a parallel to those characters in the film, both of whom, you know, would like to find a solution. And you feel if you got them in the room together, they would actually figure it out.
Robin Barnwell, thank you. The film is called Israel and Gaza Into the Abyss, and it is on ITV and ITVX on Sunday evening at 20 past 10.
The time, 10 to 9. Why is Elon Musk shutting down the headquarters of X in San Francisco and moving to Austin, Texas? Tax is part of it. He's following a trend in that respect, although he also says social legislation in California, including schools letting kids change gender without telling their parents, is the kind of thing that has pushed him to go. But it is, as I say, part of a wider trend and an interesting one in American society. And Helen Lewis is on the line, staff writer at The Atlantic, who has been writing indeed about this. Morning to you.
Good morning.
It's quite a change, isn't it? And it's quite a big deal for Austin.
Yeah, I mean, Austin has had this incredible transformation, really, in the last 5 to 10 years. In my piece is about Joe Rogan, the kind of uber popular podcaster. And he brought a whole kind of ideology, really, with him. People who weren't fully right wing, but also had kind of rejected California too. And I would say Elon Musk is further along that trajectory, but you have to see this somehow as a rejection of what California symbolizes in American political thought, right? Which is ultra progressivism in social terms. It is being extremely progressive, for example, on gender is a really big deal about that. But it is also about, you know, COVID restrictions were very, very severe in California. You know, people were masking outside, schools were closed for a really long time. And that has caused a big reaction among lots of people in Silicon Valley who thought of themselves as sort of squishily socially liberal, but have moved rightwards, both driven by gender and by COVID.
Does it do anything politically to Texas?
Well, it's very interesting because Austin is notoriously a very blue city in a very red state. And that's,
yeah, so blue meaning Democrat.
Yeah, exactly. So that's definitely part of what's happening here, is that people, you know, like Elon Musk, like Joe Rogan, want to live somewhere. I put it in the article as, you know, has low taxes, has guns, has kombucha, you know, has you know, nice supermarkets where you can get organic milk and, you know, nice barbecue restaurants. So they kind of want all the amenities of a, you know, a very progressive urban center, but without the politics, really. And that relationship between Elon Musk and California has been breaking down for a while. I mean, he's already moved the Boring Company, which is his tunneling business, out to the outskirts of Austin. Tesla has a manufacturing base outside Austin. And although for all these talks about the kind of woke mind virus, some of this is a very pragmatic business decision about regulation and taxes.
Yeah. And of course, taxes at the individual level as well, which is helpful for employees sort of further down the line in these companies. I mean, are we saying California is over? Is that the tone of your piece?
Well, I think California has moved further away from the center in the last 5 years. You know, there's been a polarization in American politics over the rise of Donald Trump. I think it kind of caused a counter reaction on the left as people moved further left in response to that, became much more energized by it. And then left sort of people in the middle in this strange place where they had to pick really a side. And people obviously found that quite uncomfortable. California has some great natural advantages, not least that, you know, if you want to hire engineers, it's where they all live. You know, Silicon Valley is a huge exchange base for people coming out of Stanford.
Well, you wonder if that changes, though, now. I mean, I suppose Stanford can't move, or maybe it can. But I mean, is this enough of a thing that actually that kind of infrastructure, eco-culture, I suppose, exists now outside California in a way that it hasn't?
I think there's a definite attempt to do this. So Joe Lonsdale, who is a venture capitalist, one of the co-founders of Palantir, which is Peter Thiel's venture capital business, has put a lot of money into the UATX, University of Texas Austin, which has got its first class coming this fall, as I now have to say, reporting for an American yeah. magazine. But that is an attempt really to say American universities are too left-wing, which is something that we hear in Britain too. And we want to build a new type of university. The stand-up scene, you know, traditionally very bi-coastal, so very much based in Los Angeles and New York. Joe Rogan now has a comedy club called the Comedy Mothership, and some of the biggest comedians in America, so Shane Gillis, Tony Hinchcliffe, people with these massive comedy podcasts, have relocated to Austin. So there's an attempt to rebuild Austin as a new kind of hub in all these different ways that we really only at the moment associate with the coasts.
Helen Lewis, staff writer at The Atlantic, they're still with the English accent. Thank you.
5 to 9.
Now, 22 years on, the Grand Tour is coming to an end. The Grand Tour that started as Top Gear and brought together Jeremy Clarkson, Richard Hammond and James May. The Grand Tour, One for the Road, is on Amazon Prime from today, and that is it. There have been, of course, high-speed stunts, explosions, crashes, smashes, but at the heart of it all, just a relationship between three chaps.
What do people talk about when they don't drink?
Oh, I don't know, actually.
That's a good point. Brexit. We've worked together now for many years, but we've never struggled to think of anything to say before.
But I think that's partly because we can never remember what we said last time, so we just do it again.
Yeah, that's a fact.
James May is here in the studio.
Good morning.
Good point, James. Was it time? I mean, what's the reason for it coming to an end? You all look hale and hearty.
But we are getting on a bit, and everything does have to end. And I think, to be honest, well, two things. We wanted to end it on our own terms. As we always used to say, we want to land it safely, not fly it into a cliff. And I think we've largely exhausted our take on the subject. Not the subject itself. There's space, I think, for a new approach to it, but it can't come from us. We're a bit too stuck in our way of doing it.
But is the subject cars, or is the subject the friendship between three men?
Oh, I sometimes wonder if it is friendship. We wind each other up so badly. But it's, I mean, it definitely started off as cars, and it's rooted in our enthusiasm for them, and even, dare I say it, our knowledge of them. But it is also about, yes, it's about human relationships, and without wishing to sound too pretentious, also the human condition. It's a view of what life means through, well, from the perspective of people who are a bit overly obsessed about cars.
No,
and, of course, it also turned into a travel show, a pantomime, a circus, all these other things as well.
And, and lots of crashes and stuff along the way,
as
we were hearing. But in this final... In this kind of grand finale, I mean, certainly from the tone of that clip, what a more relaxed approach.
Yes, we decided before we set off that, as we knew as the last one, we'd managed to decide that for ourselves before we were formally cancelled, that we would take a more relaxed approach to it, and a more, I suppose, in a way, a more real. And yes, a more gentle approach, that we chose cars that we'd liked as kids, and that we knew we were on the last one, and we would, you know, it would be slightly melancholic, slightly reflective. And that informs the whole show, I think.
Will you miss the others, working with the others or being with the others? What's your relationship like with them?
Yes, I mean, I did say somewhere else recently it would be hard to settle down to two modest holidays a year after 22 years of global adventuring. And I will miss it, but I'm glad we've brought it to a satisfactory conclusion.
I'm noting that's not an answer to whether you'll miss the other two.
Well, I don't think it's the last I've seen of them, to be brutally honest. I think there is now no escape. I mean, this job has occupied over a third of my life. Yeah. And the longest I managed to hold down any other job in my life was about a year and a half. So, you know.
You managed to hold down the job of guest editing the Today programme for a day, I suppose.
For a few hours, yes. But that's generally how it
goes. It's part of it that cars are so boring this day. They're all called mobility solutions, and they're not kind of, they don't have fins and loud noises and all the rest of it.
Well, I don't share Jeremy's view on this. He thinks that the future of cars is boring and that all cars look the same. But actually, everybody's said that. My dad was saying that in the 80s, and I expect people were saying it in the 50s, and they yearned for interwar cars. I think the subject of cars, everything about them, the cars themselves, how we use them, what they represent, has never been more interesting. But it needs a reformatting and a rethinking of the car show, which, you know, as you've observed, ours hardly was anymore. And it will need younger people, I think, people currently unknown, to come and readdress the subject and find a new way of thinking about it and articulating what it is that a younger generation thinks about it.